All right, on with it. Welcome to the Radical Agenda. It's a show about common sense extremism where we talk about radical, crazy, off-the-wall things like armed standoffs with the United States federal government. Yes, this agenda is quite radical, and welcome to it. This 84th episode of the program today is January 4th, 2016. It's a Monday, and we are coming to you live from my sorry excuse for a studio in Keene, New Hampshire. I'm kind of feeling like a badass. I've been practicing my draw. I've just been pulling a gun out of myself in the mirror. And in the course of doing that, right, like I'm practicing my draw, I got a new handgun. If you've been listening, you know, I got a Glock 17 9mm and the Black Hawk holster with the retention button. And so I'm getting used to drawing that weapon. And then today I got the laser for that weapon as well. So now, prior to that, I was carrying a Taurus 38 caliber, 38 special revolver, and I have the laser on that too. So now I'm walking around with two pistols on my hip, and both of them have lasers on it, right? And I'm feeling like you seen the movie Tombstone, right? And Doc Holliday, right? They go to get a gunfight with the bad guys, you know, and the guy goes, "It's the drunk piano player. You can't hit nothing. You're so drunk, you'll probably see in double." And he pulls out, and he's like, "I got two guns, one for each of you." 218-936-0815, Radical Agenda on Skype. Lot to get into today, lot to get into. And there's this thing going on over there in Oregon, which is quite the happening. It's quite the happening over there. It seems that some militiamen have taken over a federal building at some sort of wildlife reserve, and the federal government's none too happy about that. None too happy about the militia taking over their building. Surprisingly enough, right? Because, I mean, normally the federal government is fucking ecstatic about that kind of shit. You know, the federal government usually is like, "Oh, yeah, come on. Why don't a bunch of militant patriots come take over our buildings?" I'm so surprised. I don't know why they're all bent out of shape about it. But they are, you know, as it were, and we'll see what happens. It seems that the left, surprisingly enough, you know, because, you know, liberals are usually so enthusiastic when people are rising up against the oppressor, right? You know, when a bunch of blacks are burning down Ferguson in Baltimore, that's fucking fantastic, right? When people are burning their own communities to the ground over all matter of nonsense. You know, liberals are like, "This is fantastic." That's right. Yeah, block traffic, occupy privately owned businesses, burn your communities to the ground, beat the fucking shit out of people, kill police officers. Liberals just love that kind of resistance. But for some reason, when a bunch of, like, white males go into a federal building that nobody's at with firearms and say, "Hey, I think we're going to stick around a while," all of a sudden, the liberals call them terrorists. And, you know, far be it for me to think that these fucking bastards make any sense. So, 218-936-0815, Radical Agenda on the Skype. I got, Ryan Dawson on the line. Ryan, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
It's good to be with you, buddy. I haven't really talked to you a whole lot in a while. I mentioned in the blog post for the show today, I first became aware of you when I was sort of first getting involved in YouTube, and I took a couple of shots at the amazing atheist, TJ, whatever the fuck his name is there. And
Bananarama?
Yeah, Bananarama, the guy who was fucking ramming bananas up his fucking ass. And then I saw, as when I made the video, and then I saw some videos of yours, I think you were taking a couple of pot shots at him too. And I became
I ended him. I had forgotten about that until I saw your write-up. Like, oh, yeah. Put that guy, yeah. I'd forgotten all about him, but it's amazing. I take people to Woodshed now and then, and I thought it would be more like religious kooks and stuff, but looking back at it, I've taken more atheists to the Woodshed than any other other category.
You know, it's kind of funny you bring that up because I've had a similar experience, right? I hated, you know, growing up, I hated the religious thing. And when I first started getting involved in politics, I figured that I would have to do a great deal of combat with the religious folks. But you know what? The further I've come in politics, the more I realize that the atheists are my political enemies, and the more I end up making common cause with the religious people.
Well, it's like you have different types of atheists. I mean, I'm an atheist myself, but there seems to be a group out there that have abandoned the kind of, I don't know, classic voodoo, magic type religions, but then they find other religions, other kind of cults to cling on to, whether it's, you know, about doomsday scenarios of climate change or what have you. That's the sort of progressive leftist religion. It has infiltrated a lot of atheist thinkers.
Certainly, certainly. The statheists, as I like to call them, they are, all about their deity, which is the cult of the omnipotent state.
Staters gonna hate.
Yeah, exactly. So let's see. Surprisingly enough, we've already got calls on the line. So let's go to, Charles is on Skype here. Then we'll go into we'll try to get into the Oregon thing.
What's up,
Charles,
Chuck?
Charles, you're on the Radical Agenda. What's your agenda?
Hey, hi, Chris. Hope you're doing well. I have two, ideas I wanted your opinion on. One, how leftists operate and how we can use presently existing institutions to our benefit. The left operates in a lot of ways, but I want to talk about two. They make incremental progress, and they agitate constantly. For example, America was at one point a lot freer and more masculine, than it is today. It didn't become an anti-white society of trannies and other degenerates overnight. Leftists, they make these small victories within academia, then they take control of the media, then they exploited democracy to exercise the monopoly of force that the state has in their own favor, right? They also agitate for leftward, you know, quote, progress, unquote, constantly by having the most radical and sane members pushing for more, you know, bullshit basically constantly, like they recently won on gay marriage, and now they're working on pedophilia acceptance. Do you think this is an accurate assessment, and how do you think we could use those tactics for the cause of liberty? What are some ways that we can use presently existing institutions, such as the state, to agitate for the cause of liberty?
Well, I do think that your assessment is accurate. I've remarked on this before, is that basically they just keep on ratcheting it up. It's not like you give in to like one bit of degeneracy and then they're all of a sudden like, oh wow, you're very tolerant. No, they figure out another thing to call you a bigot about. Not too long ago, I was reading a piece in New York Magazine that these fucking lunatics are trying to normalize horse fucking. And so, where the fuck does it end when they're like, damn, we're running out of degeneracy. Can we find a horse fucker, and somebody's like, I've got a horse fucker right here, and then they're doing this thing in fucking New York Magazine. So, yeah, I mean, they just keep on ratcheting it up. How can we do the same thing? It's sort of difficult, but I would say, like, I have a piece up which pissed off a lot of people, you know, as I have this nasty habit of doing, where there was some stupid, like, lunatic feminist broads decided to go take their fucking tits out at the beach. And, went to court and said, well, I did it in, protest of rape culture and shit. And yeah. So, and then somebody in the New Hampshire state legislature said, well, we're going to pass a law to ban this on the state level. And, you know, this other state rep, you know, pipes up, nah, you're a bunch of misogynists. And you know what? Like, I'm a libertarian. I'm an anarchist. Like, I don't want to empower the government to do anything. But you know what? I'm sort of starting to come to have some sympathy for, well, let's oppress the left. Let's fucking ban this shit and say, if you want to go fucking throw your tits in children's faces, then go to fucking California, asshole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Ryan?
They seem to be obsessed with biological categories and isms. I mean, if they run out of them, they'll invent some new ones. They'll invent some new genders and then get pissed off about that. That seems to be the core of their ideology, is being completely obsessed with, you know, any kind of racial or sexual or biological category, even the ones they invent.
Well, that's the thing with this one, too, is that one of these fucking lunatics goes by the name of Barbara, has a set of tits, probably a vagina, but does not claims in court not to identify as female.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, so, I mean, these fucking lunatics, you know, I mean, I'm to a point, you know, as I've said before, like, chuck these people out of fucking helicopter. I'm done, right? Like, I am so done with negotiating with them or trying to, like, have a reasonable conversation. Some fucking asshole on Twitter the other day insisted to me that conservatives were running North Korea. Okay, so like this is not a reasonable conversation. So yeah, you know what?
That's like small government, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really getting to a point of like, fine, like use the government to just make their fucking lives miserable. Just ban everything they like, and like, and this is my strategy for anarchy, is to like just make statist lives miserable with the government. I don't know if it's like a sound strategy or not, but this is how I feel, you know. And whether or not that's gonna work, I don't know. But I have no sympathy for these fucking assholes anymore. And maybe that's clouding my judgment, but that's how I feel right now.
Yeah, I think what you do is very important in the sense that, you know, this constant agitation, like, we know that it works. And so even if we do, you know, get to a point that we do have a voluntary society, I think there's going to need to be a continuation of the agitation in the sense that people, like, cannot be given a chance to be lured into a sense of, like, oh, well, things are going to be good now forever.
Well, yeah,
I think you have to stop seeking validation from the state. Like, with marriage, I don't give a damn who marries who at all. Like, I don't think the state should be involved in marriage. I don't think we should be looking to external validation to say something's okay or not. It doesn't matter if the state says it's okay or not. It's not based on what the state's opinion of something is. It's based on your opinion of what it is. So you don't have to accept what the state says or a judge says. Just some dude in a robe, you know, who gives a fuck what they want to think. I think another plan of action would be what Bill Hicks did, and that's the strategy of out-evangelizing the evangelical. Like what he did with people with abortion rights, they were going around putting up posters of fetuses or something, and so he called up their number and said, "How dare you post pictures of naked children all over my town?" Well, but you just go more left than they do to show how ridiculous it is. It's like someone driving, you know, anybody faster than them is crazy, anybody slower than them is an idiot. And so what you got to do is go wackier than they do to make it sometimes to help point it out to these people using comedy.
Right on, man, right on. Charles, I'm going to drop you. Your audio is not so good, so I'm going to let you go, but I appreciate your input, and I thank you very much for the call. 218-936-0815, Radical Agenda on Skype. 480, you're on the Radical Agenda. What's your agenda?
Hey, Chris, put me out on hold, buddy. I'm driving. I can't talk to you right now. Sorry, yeah, man.
Okay. Tuned in to listen? Okay. 218-936-0815, Radical Agenda on the Skype there. So we were getting into this thing, with this Oregon militia. These guys, there's been a situation has been going out there for a long time. A lot of you probably remember there was a situation out at the Bundy Ranch in 2014, and there was this huge standoff with, like, Patriot groups, Oath Keepers, that sort of thing, and they actually managed to back down the Bureau of Land Management. And that was seen as a victory for a lot of people. I wasn't so hot on the whole, like, Bundy Ranch thing personally. I felt like, okay, this guy owns this piece of land, and then he wants his cattle to go graze in some land that he doesn't own. Like, why should he be able to, like, I felt like it was almost like a farm subsidy or something like that. Now, and I wrote about that, and, you know, some people explained to me afterwards, well, you know, part of his property right is he's got the grazing rights over here, and, you know, if I'm entirely honest with you, I don't entirely understand the thing, but some people who are more learned than I turned around and told me that I was completely fucking wrong about that, and I'm willing to take their word for it.
Well, apparently they arbitrarily raised the price for the grazing rights or permits or whatever after they couldn't get people to sell what they wanted, and it's similar to what's happening now.
Well, yeah, and what I read today, so you had pasted to me the article from the Conservative Treehouse. Everybody's been feeding me that one, and I did link to it in my article today. The piece up on my website is in Oregon, Rumors of War. And I've got that up on the YouTube channel as a video as well. And I linked to the piece in the Conservative Treehouse, and they gave a very good outline of what's been going on. And it is fucking egregious. I mean, this has been going on since, like, the 60s, that the federal government is going and buying up all this land for their stupid wildlife refuge. And so then the ranchers who don't want to sell, they harass them for fucking decades. And it just gets increasingly belligerent because they're basically like, look, accept the inevitability that we're taking your fucking land already and get out of here. And people don't want to do it. And, so they keep on ratcheting up the pressure is what seems to have been happening there, for some period of time.
Well, the worst thing is the trying to throw them in jail for 5 years for setting a backfire to save their own property from a lightning fire, which they put out themselves. And they're calling them arsonists and terrorists for that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what it ultimately culminates in is, I mean, there's a lot of things that led up to it. They had, like, you know, they were blocking the road to their house. I'm going to pull up a couple of highlights here from it.
Yeah, the government was blocking the road to their house, and the roads were even in a different county, and they had no right to do that anyhow.
Right. They don't, you know, these people just act like there's no fucking rules. So they, let's see here. So, In 1908, President Theodore Roosevelt, in a political scheme, created an Indian reservation around the Mulgar, Mud, and Harney Lakes and declared it as a preserve and breeding ground for native birds. Later, this Indian reservation, without Indians, became the Mulgar National Wildlife Refuge. In 1964, the Hammonds purchased their ranch in the Harney Basin. The purchase included approximately 6,000 acres of private property, 4 grazing rights on public land, a small ranch, and 3 water rights. The ranch is around 53 miles south of Burns, Oregon. By the 1970s, nearly all the ranches adjacent to the Blitzen Valley were purchased by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and added to the Mulgar National Wildlife Refuge. The refuge covers over 187,000 acres, stretches over 45 miles long and 37 miles wide. The expansion of the refuge grew and surrounds Hammonds Ranch. Approached many times by the FWS, the Hammonds refused to sell. Other ranchers also chose not to sell. During the 1970s, the Fish and Wildlife Service, in conjunction with the Bureau of Land Management, took a different approach to get the ranchers to sell. Ranchers were told grazing was detrimental to wildlife and must be reduced. 32 out of 53 permits were revoked, and many ranchers were forced to leave. Grazing fees were raised significantly for those who were allowed to remain. Refuge personnel took over the irrigation system, claiming it as their own. So, you know, you buy a piece of property, right? And the piece of property has a value assigned to it based on certain conditions that are going on in the area. And then the United States federal government comes in and says, you know what? I think we're just going to change the rules around on you. Yeah, and so, shockingly enough, you know, people are kind of upset about this.
Well, there's a long history of that, and a lot of it started with Teddy Roosevelt, and I know a lot about this, because it happened on the island where I grew up with the National Park Service seizing land and de facto taking a recreational park and creating a wildlife preserve out of it, even though all the properties adjacent to the park, which was the fucking beach on an island that they closed down, they closed it down, and of course the businesses went in the toilet. People lost, you know, 70% of their earnings or more. It was very devastating, and they didn't give a damn. They do this all the time. And there's a Michael Crichton, the guy that wrote Jurassic Park, has a lot to say about this on the other side of the Mississippi with the Forest Reserve and how they confiscated land. And what they did is really they were just temporarily preserving land and keeping it off the open market away from competitors, but they allow the Forest Reserve and government agencies to go do its logging and whatever have you themselves. And so they would use environmental pretexts or Indian reservations that didn't have any Indians and any excuse they could to confiscate land from people. And sometimes just confiscating land adjacent to people, you know, it devalues their own property and they're routinely breaking their promises. And so I'm very happy that people are physically standing up to the government.
Well, I mean, on one hand, I'm happy to see that people are standing up to the government. The other problem that I have with it, though, is it doesn't seem to be like this is going to pan out well, right? I mean, I'm tempted in some ways to cheer for civil unrest for the sake of civil unrest, right? But I don't want to turn into one of these guys. I mean, you know, you saw this, a lot of libertarians did this with the Black Lives Matter thing, that they're like, oh, a bunch of people are angry at the government. That's fucking fantastic, right? But of course, this was a bunch of reality detached lunatics who were, you know, destroying private property and whatnot. Now that's not the case with the militia guys, but it does seem to me that they're sort of, they're going and laying claim to something that, well, firstly, the Hammonds are not asking for their help. That was one of the things that came out from Oath Keepers, right? So Stuart Rhodes has a piece over at oathkeepers.org where he's actually got 2 videos up. One is a conference call with him and several other Oath Keepers, you know, senior figures or whatever. And another is just an interview that he had with some folks prior to this incident where, you know, he had spoken to the Hammond family, and they were not asking for the assistance of Oath Keepers or any other patriot groups. And so the family that they are supposedly standing in defense of has, you know, said, hey, this is not what we want. And then they're going and they're just claiming, you know, some land that has, well, I mean, I'm not going to say it has nothing to do with it, but it's not the land in question, right? They're going and taking over a federal building and saying, hey, we're going to lay claim to these, you know, 187,000 acres of land, and we're all going to stay here for years, and we invite all of these people from all around the country to come join us here and defend this piece of property. But it seems to me that if they opt to try to defend this piece of land, that they're going to get themselves killed. And as much as I like to see people who are willing to kill and die for a cause, it seems to me that they're very likely to either end up surrendering and in prison or leave there in fucking boxes.
Or, you know, just using it as leverage to negotiate some sort of settlement with the case that's going on. I mean, you had the American Indian Movement raise up in 1973 and retake Wounded Knee, and they knew they weren't going to take on the U.S. military or the FBI. But they held them at bay for 3 months and until the media lost attention on that and got into Watergate. But you even had Marlon Brando mention it during the Academy Awards. It was a big deal in the 70s, and they were able to negotiate and get some of these goons, these police abuses on their reservations dealt with. They didn't get everything they were promised, of course, but that's routine lying to Indians. But they needed to do something theatrical and extreme to change the situation because nothing else was working. And I feel like that might be the case with these people because this has been going on for many decades and they've just been ignored.
Well, there's that. I mean, there is the case to be made that if, you know, people... governments victimize people because they can, essentially, right? If there's no threat of force there, then there's really no reason for an aggressor to stop, right? So it is encouraging to see people, you know, willing to take those chances. You know, this is part of the concern I have, though, is it seems to me, from what I read at Oath Keepers, you know, Amon Bundy, I don't know, you know, if he's really being entirely forthcoming about what's going on there, right? Like, he seems to have told all these people, hey, we're standing in defense of the Hammond family, when the Hammond family doesn't want their help, and now he's just trying to go and lay claim to a piece of property there. And, you know, this has the potential to certainly wind up fatal. There was the Blaze has a story here that Montel Williams says, quote, totally fine with a massive use of deadly force in Oregon to take out Amon Bundy. And it was trending on Twitter, Oregon under attack, and they dubbed these people Y'al-Qaeda. And so here's a story in the Blaze. As the armed occupation of a federal building in the National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon continues, TV talk show host Montel Williams took to Twitter on Sunday with some blunt solutions to the situation. Montel Williams tweeted, "It appears hashtag Oregon under attack by a bunch of undereducated terrorist buffoons who follow hashtag Cliven Bundy. Shall we send them to meet ISIS?" You know, it's interesting to me that they don't seem to have a problem with Black Lives Matter.
When you have the LA riots, let's write a song about it. You know?
Yeah, Black Lives Matter can go burn Ferguson to the ground. They can go fucking set the a CVS on fire in Baltimore, and that's just fantastic. This is just seen as people rising up against their oppressor. These guys go to do that, and you have Montel Williams, of all fucking people, out on Twitter, calling to have a, sending them to meet ISIS, for fuck's sake.
Let's have another Waco, because that worked out so well without any future consequences last time.
Well, you know, this is the thing, you know, I mean, these like 3%er groups, I mean, this is their thing. They say no more free Wacos. I got a piece at the Sipsey Street Irregulars here as well. The story in the Blaze continues. Amon Bundy, the son of Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy, who was involved in a 2014 standoff with government over grazing rights, is among the people at the headquarters of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. It was unclear exactly how many people were taking place in the protests. And then below this, we got the tweet from Montel Williams. Totally fine with a massive use of deadly force in Oregon to take out Amon Bundy. Hashtag Oregon under attack.
Haven't heard any people. They took over a building that wasn't even occupied. And he wants to murder these people for that. Why don't they just let them graze their fucking cows?
Well, exactly. You know, he got another tweet here. Then let's give them some. put this down using National Guard with shoot to kill orders. The story in The Blaze continues, Bundy and other militia members came to Burns last month, a small town about 280 miles southeast of Portland, Oregon. They were upset over the looming prison sentences for local ranchers Dwight and Steve Hammond. They went to the wildlife refuge Saturday evening following a peaceful rally in Burns to support the ranchers. You know, I should probably go back into the piece in the Conservative Treehouse and give a little more background here. I want to get to the fire. Because there are two fires. I should just explain this. I imagine a lot of you have probably read the piece in the Conservative Treehouse, but for those of you who haven't, let me give you the background here. In early fall of 2001, Steve Hammond called the fire department informing them that he was going to be performing a routine prescribed burn on their ranch. Later that day, he started a prescribed fire on their property. The fire went onto public land and burned 127 acres of grass. The Hammonds put the fire out themselves. There was no communication about the burn from the federal government to the Hammonds at the time. Prescribed fires are a common method that Native Americans and ranchers have used in the area to increase the health and productivity of the land for many centuries. In 2006, a massive lightning storm started multiple fires that joined together, inflaming the countryside. To prevent the fire from destroying their winter range and possibly their home, Stephen Hammond started a backfire on their property. The backfire was successful in putting out the lightning fires that had covered thousands of acres within a short period of time. The backfire saved much of the range, and vegetation was needed to feed the cattle through the winter. Stephen's mother, Susan Hammond, said the backfire worked perfectly. It put out the fire, saved the ranch, and possibly our home. The next day, federal agents went to the Harney County Sheriff's office and filed a police report making accusation against Dwight and Stephen Hammond for starting the backfire. A few days after the backfire, a range con from the Burns District BLM office asked Stephen if he would meet with him in town for coffee. Stephen accepted. When leaving, he was arrested by Harney County Sheriff Dave Glareup and BLM Ranger Orr. Sheriff Glareup then ordered him to go to the ranch and bring back his father. Both Dwight and Stephen were booked on multiple Oregon state charges. The Harney County District Attorney reviewed the accusation, evidence, and charges and determined the accusations against Dwight and Stephen Hammond did not warrant prosecution and dropped all of the charges. But then in 2011, 5 years after the police report was taken, the U.S. Attorney's Office accused Dwight and Stephen Hammond of a completely different charge. They accused them of being terrorists under the Federal Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. This act carries a minimum sentence of 5 years in prison and a maximum sentence of death. These guys put out a fire. They lit a fire. They did light a fire, you know. And when
I first
heard about this, you know, because this is the thing. If you don't read the entire thing, and this is why I linked to the piece at Conservative Treehouse, and I'm really glad to what was the name of the person who put this together here? This was by Sundance at the Conservative Treehouse. When I first heard about this story, I'm like, okay, so they set fire to some federal lands. They're arsonists. What the fuck do I care about what happened to them? The nature of the fire was to put out another fire. The fire on federal lands was coming to burn down their fucking house, and then they set a backfire to stop it, and that backfire actually helped to stop the fire that was on the federal lands. So,
and they were cleared of all charges.
And they were cleared of all charges by the district attorney in the county. But, of course, the federal prosecutor decides, hey, I've got an idea. We've been trying to take their fucking house for decades. Let's charge them with terrorism. And a minimum 5 years, maximum sentence of death for putting out a fire. Really, really fucking classy federal government. Dwight and Stephen's mugshots were all over the news the next week, posing them as arsonists. Susan Hammond, wife and mother, said, I would walk down the street or go in a store. People I had known for years would take extreme measures to avoid me. Shortly after the sentencing, Capital Press ran a story about the Hammonds. A person who was identified as Greg Allum posted three comments on the article, calling the ranchers clowns who endangered firefighters and other people in the area while burning valuable rangeland. Greg Allum, a retired BLM heavy equipment operator, soon called Capitol Press to complain he had not made those comments and requested they be taken down from the website. Capitol Press removed the comments. A search of the Internet Protocol address associated with the comments revealed the origin as the BLM's office in Denver, Colorado. Alum said he is friends with the Hammonds and he was alerted to the comments by neighbors. In September 2006, Dwight and Susan Hammond's home was raided. The agents informed the Hammonds they were looking for evidence that would connect them to the fires. I don't know what the fucking evidence they're looking for. They confessed to it. The Hammonds later found a boot print and tire tracks were found near one of the many fires. No matching boots or tires were found in the Hammonds' home or on their property. Susan Hammond, wife, later said, "I have never felt so violated in my life. We are ranchers, not criminals." Stephen Hammond openly maintains his testimony that he started the backfire to save the winter grass from being destroyed, and the backfire ended up working so well that it put the fire out altogether. During the trial proceedings, federal court judge Michael Hogan did not allow time for certain testimonies and evidence into the trial, which would exonerate the Hammonds. Federal prosecuting attorney Frank Papagni, was given full access for 6 days. He had ample time to use any evidence or testimony that strengthened the demonization of the Hammonds. The Hammonds' attorney was only allowed 1 day. Many of the facts about the fires, land, and why the Hammonds acted the way they did was not allowed into the proceedings and was not heard by the jury. Example, Judge Hogan did not allow time for the jury to hear or review scientific findings that the fire improved the health and productivity of the land or that the Hammonds had been subject to vindictive behavior by multiple federal agencies for years. Federal attorneys Frank Papagni hunted down a witness who was not mentally capable to be credible. Dusty Hammond, grandson and nephew, testified that Stephen told him to start a fire. He was 13 years old at the time and 24 years old when he testified 11 years later. At 24, Dusty had been suffering with mental problems for many years. He had been estranged from his family, including his mother. Judge Hogan noted that Dusty's memories as a 13-year-old boy were not clear or credible. However, Judge Hogan allowed the prosecution to continually use Dusty's testimony. When speaking to the Hammonds about his testimony, they understood Dusty was manipulated and expressed nothing but love for their troubled grandson.
How was any of this terrorism anyway?
Well,
and that's
I mean,
the motive to just go burn a field.
Well, this is the thing, you know, I mean, we're supposed to, you know, the guy shoots up Fort Hood, right? And Barack Obama comes out and says, this is workplace violence. You know, what's his fucking name? Tashfeen Malik and what's the guy's name again there? And San Bernardino, you know? You know, they eventually come out and say that it's terrorism, but they're like, oh, we don't know yet. We don't know. Maybe it's terrorism. Maybe it's just a couple of disgruntled workers who are shooting up the Christmas party while screaming Allahu Akbar at people. Who knows?
I'm not sure about that one because they didn't leave behind their passports. Muslims always leave their passports behind when they commit terrorism.
You know, I also thought it was kind of, you know, people during the San Bernardino thing, they were, you know, there's a lot of speculation that they were white people at first. And I believed it because they tried to get away. You know, Muslims, they don't usually try to get away. They're just like, Allahu Akbar and wait for the fucking, blow themselves up or whatever. But, you know, who knows?
Every other shooting, though, is just a shooting. It's never an act of terrorism when people shoot up a school or a movie theater or a church or whatever, like has happened in the last few years. They don't really label them as terrorists. Well, what else could it be? Are they just crazy? You don't think some terrorists are just crazy?
Well, I imagine you'd have to be crazy to do some of the fucking things that these people do. And
I mean, it's pointless. Like, if you're pissed at the government, go shoot cops or something. You don't just randomly shoot civilians.
Well, you know, I mean, this was sort of the point that I was making, though, is that, you know, if you want to, in some cases, I mean, not that it's a, not that I think that it's a good thing to do, when you have these guys who go out and do these, you know, these suicide attacks and whatnot, it scares the shit out of the populace, right? I mean, there's a difference between you go to war with the government, you know, if these guys, let's say these guys go and, decide to fight for this, this federal building, right? Well, what's gonna happen is the United States federal government's gonna fucking kill all of them, right? And absolutely nothing will change as a result of it. This is going to basically, you know, this is like a martyrdom, a suicide mission. Now, when these lunatics, you know, these ISIS guys and whatever, they go out and they commit suicide attacks. They do manage to stir things up, right? Because they go kill a bunch of civilians. They don't scare the government, but they certainly scare the fucking living shit out of the populace. And then the populace says, hey, government, keep me safe. And shockingly enough, the government proves incapable of doing that, but does visit endless amounts of misery upon the populace.
Well, if ISIS wanted maximum effect, they'd just go sit outside of D.C. and pick up a congressman on his way to lunch, or go to Wall Street and blow up some rich people. That would really make shit hit the fan. They're not going to do that. That's
no,
not going to happen.
No, probably not. 218-936-0815, Radical Agenda on the Skype if you'd like to be on the program. So as we continuing on with the piece in Conservative.
Do you remember the DC snipers as well, you know?
Yeah.
And that ended up being a couple of black guys, and then you saw the media completely reverse on calling them terrorists or not. It was just, oh, Tim Malvo, and he had PTSD and da 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 da.
Yeah, he was a sweet boy. He didn't do nothing.
Yeah. They were terrorists.
I love that too. You know, what are they? You know, everybody after the Dylann Roof thing, right? They all say it was fucking white privilege because Dylann Roof was taken alive. You know, and they said, oh, Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin, they got killed, but this guy, he got out alive because he's a white privilege.
Roof guy was arrested in North Carolina, which doesn't have cops trained by the Israelis like New York City does, which is choking people to death. There's a very big difference there. When you're getting trained by an apartheid state, of course they'll kill you on the spot.
What, is that the case that the Israeli government is training the NYPD? I wasn't aware of that one.
Yep, absolutely. That's where they go over to get training. And, you know, and they treat everybody like it's like they do Palestinians. It's just a fucking war zone. There are no civilians. And so, you know, routinely, like the only time in recent times that I can remember a cop actually getting in trouble was the cop in South Carolina that shot somebody who was running away on film, and he got prosecuted and sentenced for it. But most of the time when cops kill people, it's, you know, they get away with it, even if it's on film. It doesn't matter. But then there are other times where they ought to be killing people because they're criminals. And people just can't look at it on a case-by-case basis. They seem to have an ideological sort of camp where they either always side with the police or always side with the victim or criminal.
Well, I mean, and, you know, the thing about it is, you know, with the police killing people is the vast majority of time it is perfectly legal, and that might be a very good reason to have a problem with what the laws are, right? You know, even in the case of, like, Eric Garner, right? So, you know, they fucking grab this guy and, you know, choke him out on the streets of Staten Island, and people are recording it, and then they're like, why haven't you indicted this man for murder? And they're like, because that's not what our laws say murder is, right? And mm-hmm. as much as I was pissed off about the Eric Garner thing, you know, a bunch of, you know, so many people, so many libertarians run around saying I'm just a fucking racist who loves to apologize for cops killing black people. Well, no, I will do a certain amount of that, certainly. But the, you know, in the case of Eric Garner, you know, this is a fucking tax problem. I say, yeah, that's a murder, in my book, because, you have no right to go and fucking choke a man out on the street because he doesn't give you a cut of his revenues. But, simultaneously, that's what the laws are, right? The laws are, you gotta pay us fucking taxes, and if you don't, then we're gonna fuck you up and kill you. And so I'm not surprised that they don't go and indict the fucking cop for it. It might be wrong, it might be unethical, but it's, you know, not illegal, unfortunately. Let's...
Right, but you didn't have the call of racism like you did with Dylann Roof, because he was a Southerner and he had a Confederate flag, so you gotta change the historic flag that's been flying since 1961 over all the state houses because one guy who happened to be racist shot people, but in all these other shootings, they don't get concerned with that. There is a sustained effort on the part of Hollywood and others to demonize the South, are constantly calling everybody that lives in the South just, you know, and portraying them as dumb, ignorant, racist, and in the most negative light possible. When they finally find a shooter from there, it fit their narrative, and they just went all holy hell against all Southern culture collectively because of what some asshole did.
Definitely true. Let's go to the Skypes here. We've got Ian is on the line. Ian is trying to get on the line. We're
I see the dots going.
Okay, the call failed. All right, so much for that. Sorry, Ian. Tried real hard. 218-936-0815, Radical Agenda, on the Skypes there. June 22nd, 2012, Dwight and Stephen were found guilty of starting both the 2001 and the 2006 fires by the jury. However, the federal courts convicted them both as terrorists under the 1996 Anti-Terrorism Act. Judge Hogan sentenced Dwight, the father, to 3 months in prison and Stephen, the son, to 12 months in federal prison. Both were stipulated to pay $400,000 to the BLM. Judge Hogan, overruling the minimum terrorist sentence, commented, if the full 5 years were required, it would be a violation of the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. The day of the sentencing, Judge Hogan retired as a federal judge. In his honor, the staff served chocolate cake in the courtroom. On January 4th, 2013, Dwight and Stephen reported to prison. They fulfilled their sentences, Dwight 3 months and Stephen 12. Dwight was released March of 2013 and Stephen in January of 2014. Sometime in June 2014, Rhonda Cargs, field manager for the Bureau of Land Management, and her husband, Chad Cargs, refuge manager for the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, which surrounds the Hammond Ranch, along with attorney Frank Papagni, exemplified further vindictive behavior by filing an appeal with the Ninth District Federal Court seeking Dwight's and Steve's return to federal prison for the entire 5 years. In October of 2015, the Ninth District Court resentenced Dwight and Stephen, requiring them to return to prison for several more years. Stephen, 46, has a wife and 3 children. Dwight, 74, will leave Susan, 74, to be alone for after 55 years of marriage. If he survives, he will be 79 when he is released. So the other thing that I wanted to get across here, which was not entirely clear to me when I'm hearing the story just through people's accounts on social media, is that it's not like they were convicted twice, okay? So they were convicted, they were sentenced, but the judge sentenced them to less than the minimum sentence, saying that it would be a cruel and unusual punishment. Because obviously the judge is like, all right, you know, the jury says, okay, well, you know, what they're charged with matches they did, right? They've confessed to setting this fire. Setting the fire is a violation of this law here, and so we're gonna, you know, find them guilty of this charge and leave it in the judge's hands. The judge says, look, yeah, they did what they're accused of, but this is ridiculous. I'm not going to sentence them to 5 years in prison.
That's the only reason they had the terrorism charge is because they couldn't have double jeopardy. They couldn't try to charge them again for something that they had already been acquitted of. So they just made up another one. They were just going to keep having charges until they got something that was thick.
No, you're irony. I think you're misunderstanding what happened here. So yes, the district attorney, the county prosecutor, or the town prosecutor, whichever it was, the local authorities, declined to follow through on the charges. They dropped them. Okay, it wasn't like they were found not guilty by a jury of their peers. The federal government brought the anti-terrorism charges. They were found guilty on the anti-terrorism charges. Okay, and they were sentenced on the terrorism charges, but they were sentenced to less than the minimum. Okay, which is, it's basically illegal what the judge did. The judge is saying, okay, I'm going to sentence you to 8 months on something that has a 5-year minimum, and then he retired afterwards, right? Because it seems to me as if he knew he was going to get reversed, but he knew that this was ridiculous too. He knew these guys were getting railroaded, so he basically stepped down after he let these guys off with a light sentence. And then after they serve their time, then the government comes back and says, no, it's illegal to sentence them to 8 months. They've got to do 5 years. And that's exactly what happened. So this is not a double jeopardy thing. It's important to understand. As much as it's fucked up, and as much as the federal government is wrong here, at least so far as statutes are concerned, it does not appear to me that they're actually doing anything illegal. Now, I would go so far as to say that it's completely unconstitutional, everything that led up to the problem, but it doesn't seem to me that this is a double jeopardy issue because they're being sentenced on the same charges where there was a 5-year minimum. Does that make sense?
I thought the terrorism charges were new in the 2006 or whatever, and the original charges were for arson. Like, because they didn't have that law until 96, so I guess they brought that up after the fact when they couldn't get them on the first original charges. Then they brought up terrorism charges.
No. The law was passed in 1996. The first fire was in 2001. The second fire was in 2006. We just finished going through that. So that's they have not been convicted twice of the same thing. What happened was they were convicted. They were sentenced to a lesser sentence, and then the prosecutors, you know, appealed and said you can't sentence him to that. There's a 5-year minimum on it, and that's That's what happened there. Let's try Ian again. I give you one more shot, Ian, and then I'm going to give up on you. I mean, this drives me crazy with the fucking Skype callers. You guys got to make sure your shit works. Go call Echo before
another
you call
ironic
me.
Thing is the wild refuge isn't even working. Supposedly the reports are that there are a lot more geese and duck and other animals that they're trying to raise there on the private property rather than the refuge.
Yeah, it's fucking ridiculous. Yeah, there was something, one of the things that they had actually said was that I lost the fucking part of it that I was going
to
look at.
Well, it was the same in North Carolina, too. They were trying to save some piping plover bird, and there were tons of them, like, sitting on the roof of the food lion and in the parking lots and things, and very few decided to lay eggs in the beach, you know, which has ocean overwash every year.
Well, it seems, you know, people always talk about human beings as if we're this fucking plague on the fucking land, and it's ridiculous, because as a matter of fact, we actually end up getting along with the rest of the fucking animals in a lot of cases. In one of the paragraphs here from the Conservative Treehouse is, by the 1990s, the Hammonds were one of very few ranchers who still owned private property adjacent to the refuge. Susie Hammond, in an effort to make sense of what was going on began compiling facts about the refuge. In a hidden public record, she found a study done by FWS in 1975. The study showed that no-use policies of FWS on the refuge were causing the wildlife to leave the refuge and move to private property. The study showed the private property adjacent to the Malheur Wildlife Refuge produced four times more ducks and geese than the refuge did. The study also showed that the migrating birds were 13 times more likely to land on private property than on the refuge. When Susie brought this to the attention of the FWS and refuge personnel, her and her family became the subjects of a long train of abuses and corruptions. And of course, this is well prior to the abuses and corruptions which we just mentioned, and you know, that resulted in the convictions and the ridiculous.
It's the same thing the Park Service did, and they found out the piping plovers were going down in population because, lo and behold, when you remove people from the park, guess what happens? All the predators return. So. Guess where the birds go? They go back to private property where they're safe.
Yeah, and so, you know, and it was the same thing with the Bundy Ranch. What were they talking about? Oh, the fucking turtles or something, right? They're like, oh, we got to do the turtle. You need to fuck the turtles up, you know.
And it's a disingenuous pretext to grab land. That's it. It's got nothing to do with the environment. But they know if they put that word in the title, you're gonna have a bunch of tree huggers and hippies just religiously agree with it without even looking at what's actually happening.
Right, and even the fucking environmental lunatics are usually being taken advantage of. Now, somebody just before the show, somebody linked this to me. This is a piece at Oregon Live from 2012. The headline is Malheur County targeted for gold and uranium mines. Sprawling Malheur County could be in the spotlight as a mining hub or a battleground of uranium and gold mining interests versus environmentalists trying to protect its lonesome sagebrush landscape. Australian-owned Oregon Energy LLC hopes to mine 18 million pounds of yellowcake uranium from the southeast Oregon High Desert, 10 miles west of McDermott, near the Oregon-Nevada boundary. The go-ahead to mine the so-called Aurora uranium deposit could bring up to 250 construction jobs to the county, followed by 150 mining jobs. Now, real quick, I want to continue with this piece here, but I'm just going to say, here's a foreign corporation is going to get the mining rights to some American lands, and at the grand old bargain of creating 250 jobs up until the point that this shit is removed from the place. And this is why public property becomes a fucking problem, right? They're like, oh, well, we're the government, and we'll just, you know, give this to this bidder that's over here, and then they'll go and take all this shit out and sell it back to us or whoever the fuck. It's crazy. And of course, the environmentalists are like, yeah, let's have the government take over all the land because the government's going to be a real good steward of the property to protect the environment and shit. And they're like, I don't know, let's have a bunch of fucking foreigners go dig uranium out of the ground.
That's why the Navajo reservation is as big as it is. They drew a big circle around uranium and they added mine it with 99-year leases to Peabody Coal and things like that. And a lot of these bids aren't really venture capitalist bids. They're rigged auctions. So it's just not even a proper bidding process. It's kind of like how the government likes to build roads.
Meanwhile, the Calico
gets the contract.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the Calico Resources USA Corp, a subsidiary of Vancouver, British Columbia Company, may seek permits this month to chemically extract microscopic gold from a high desert butt south of Vail, called Grassy Mountain, a project likely to create another 100 jobs. The proposals will be the first real test of the 1991 chemical processing mining law passed by the legislature in response to a debate over the mining's future in Oregon, said environmentalist Larry Tuttle. The law ushered in tough new bonding requirements to weed out marginal operators and guarantee environmental cleanup. In other words, to keep small business away from the job. Approval of the Grassy Mountain project could trigger a deluge of new chemical mining near Malheur County. Up to a dozen gold deposits similar to Grassy Mountain dot the high desert between the Snake River town of Huntington and Jordan Valley. The county, sparsely populated with only 31,313 people, could use new jobs, said County Commissioner Dan Joyce. Its employment rate in November was 10.3%, unemployment rate, sorry, was 10.3% compared with the 9.1% for Oregon and 8.6% for the nation. Again, this is from 2012. Mining companies have passed up the county in the past because of Oregon's environmentally conscious reputation, Joyce said. But this time, the sluggish local and state economies, higher mineral prices, and the technological advances in mining and cleanup could open a door to mining, he said. I'm thinking people are a lot hungrier now than they were, said Joyce. Oregon Energy's proposal calls for extracting ore from a mile-long, 600-foot-wide, 250-foot-deep open pit 10 miles west of McDermott and 3 miles north of the Oregon-Nevada border. The mine, adjoining the former Brett's Mercury mine and a contaminated open pit site from the 1960s, will cost $200 million to develop, and uranium extraction could continue up to 20 years, said Oregon Energy President Lachlan Reynolds. Plans call for the ore to be crushed and mixed with an acid solution in enclosed vats to leach out the uranium, he said. The acid would bond with the uranium and, when dry, become a sand-like powder called uranium oxide concentrate, or yellow cake. Yellow cake could bring $52 per pound and could fuel nuclear reactors or be processed into weapons. That's fascinating. So the federal government is like, hey, there's a bunch of shit here that we can use to make nuclear bombs. Get the fuck out of our way. And we're surprised that they're acting in a corrupt and belligerent fashion, apparently.
Yeah, but they don't want any free market competition to come in there and cultivate the land for any other uses. It's got to be for what they want. And a similar situation in North Carolina with Duke Energy and the Audubon Society, which is one of these bird-loving nut groups. They went in and prevented wind power, which they're going to put around in the Pamlico Sound. You'd think environmental groups would be for wind power. It's green energy, et cetera. But that's not what they said. Oh, it's going to hurt the birds and bats will run into the windmills or whatever. But then they went in and confiscated land, and then suddenly they released their restrictions once people personally involved in the organization have bought up coastal properties, and which, you know, their values went up in the millions once they released their restrictions. And that's the kind of thing you see happening over and over again, is they preserve land under environmental pretexts or about birds or turtles or whatever to keep land off the open market. And then suddenly, oh, now it's up for sale and it's going to this particular company, and it's something ridiculous like these $200 million. What they're doing now in Cape Hatteras is building a fucking bridge across where the Bonner Bridge used to be, over top of Pea Island, and then connecting to this other place called Rodanthe. It's a super long bridge. I think it's going to be like the second longest in the United States. Totally unnecessary. The bridge goes over land. Literally built a bridge over land. I shit you not. And people joke about a highway to nowhere. They're building a bridge over land.
Well,
and that was the environmental organization's recommendations.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much to the environmental organizations for creating all those ditch digger jobs. 218-936-0815, Radical Agenda on Skype. As we go to the phones, 480, you're on Radical Agenda. What's your agenda?
Oh, hey, Chris. Hey.
Hey.
It's the guy that was listening in the car. I tuned out for about 15 minutes. I was wondering if you read the Sipsey Street Declaration, or at least mentioned it on the air.
Well, the thing that Sipsey Street Irregulars wrote about this particular incident, or their original stuff?
No, the declaration. There's some specifically titled National 3% Declaration or something of that effect.
I think I read it a long time ago. I haven't read it on the air. I mean, but I know what you're talking about.
No. You couldn't have read it a long time ago because it was only published yesterday.
Oh, so I have no idea what you're talking about then. I've read, let me pull up Sipsey Street Irregulars here. I saw, they put out a piece about this, perfect timing for the regime. About the situation out there. Now, I don't know about if this is the declaration that you're referring to.
That's not the post. It's got the word declaration right in the title. All right, Chris, you didn't get to it. Yeah, sorry about that. Sorry, buddy. I got to go. I'd love to talk about it. Very, very interesting stuff. Thanks a lot, Chris.
All right, thanks anyway. 218-936-0815, Radical Agenda. On the on the Skypes there, let's see. So since when was it anti-constitutional for a tyrant ever interested? Declaration. Sorry. I do not see declaration. Okay, no more free Waco. No. No more free Wacos. A national 3% declaration regarding the situation in Harney County. Oh, okay. Why would I want to do that? There's plenty of you federal sons of bitches around here. So let's pull up the Sipsey Street piece here. 1996, common criminals calling themselves the Montana Freemen victimized their own neighbors in the community with fake liens and bank fraud. Eventually, the federal authorities became involved and laid siege to their community. At the time, in the aftermath of Waco and Ruby Ridge, the FBI was very concerned that members of the constitutional militia movement might come to their aid. They approached the leadership of these formations, trying to determine what their intentions were should the situation go south, turning into another Waco. As part of this effort, the FBI special agent in charge of the Albuquerque, New Mexico office journeyed downstate to visit Bob Wright, then, as now, commander of the 1st Brigade New Mexico Militia. Bob, he asked, would you really like to take your unit up to Montana to protect them? Bob looked him in the eye and said, why would I want to do that? There's plenty of you federal sons of bitches around here. Our point was, then, as it is now, that much as we disagreed with the people in the compound, we believed that the federal government had an absolute duty to respect their due process rights and to do what was necessary to end the situation without killing them. Bob's rejoinder made it clear that if it did turn to another Waco, there would be a national response and that we would fight in our own areas of operation where we were strongest. What Bob was trying to communicate was that there were prisoners of our own principle, that we were prisoners of our own principle. We had sworn after the immolation of the Davidians that we would no more, that there would be no more free Wacos, that if the feds began killing citizens without legal recourse, that they would pay a price in blood for it. Indeed, if there was one principle that everybody in the liberty movement, such as it is, agrees upon, it is that. Since then, we have sent a message in a number of ways, including no more free Wacos and explication of the obvious addressed to Eric Holder, Attorney General of the United States in 2009. I made this a central tenet of the 3% catechism. According to the other principles, is no first use of force. We call this no Fort Sumters. To do so would be a surrender, the moral high ground. The founders understood that. Indeed, even the people who responded to the righteous cause of the Bundys at the time of the standoff there understood it. Yet now we have a situation contrived by some of the same people who first showed their true colors in the aftermath of that confrontation, throwing this crucial tenet into the garbage can. I refer the reader to my article yesterday, Perfect Timing for the Regime, Federal Provocateurs, Sociopaths, and Idiots with John Brown Complexes are writing checks that they expect the rest of us to cash in our blood. And the statement of the Oregon 3% organization, whose march was exploited by the Ammon Bundy and his supporters to achieve the takeover. I hasten to add that this tactic is straight out of the Communist Provocateur's Handbook. I know, since as a former member of the Maoist Progressive Labor Party, we used to do the same thing to peaceful anti-war marches. Likewise, today's Black Flag street anarchists are doing the same thing across the world. The point of the tactics is to take the violence up several notches, goad government forces into responding, and radicalize others who are subsequently beaten and tear gassed. It is a tactic older than Karl Marx. And yet, as wrong-headed and suspect as are the actions and motives of the few people who are currently holed up in the Fish and Wildlife Service office, and they are fewer, far fewer than is claimed, the rest of us are still prisoners of our own enunciated principles. Bundy and the others, including several people who are widely suspected of being federal provocateurs, have indeed written a check that they expect the rest of us to cash in our own blood in a ghastly civil war. Yet we cannot allow the federal government to take advantage of this perfect propaganda opportunity that they have apparently spent much effort contriving and used deadly force on the occupiers without response. As at the time of the Freeman standoff, we must get across the message to the feds that if they do so, there will be a national response in those local areas of operations where we are strongest, politically and militarily. Frankly, this is a plea for any adults in the room in D.C. to intervene and use caution before this blows up in all of our faces. As to the personalities involved, I can say from personal experience on the ground at the time of the original Bundy confrontation, the sociopathic weasel and likely Fed provocateur, Ryan Payne, insinuated himself into the Bundy family by going to church with them and promising to convert to their brand of LDS church. Whether he actually did or not is unknown to me, but I was told by Bundy himself that this was the reason they trusted him and took him into their personal defense detail, as much as Cleopatra clasped the asp to her own bosom. In addition, I am informed by someone on the ground that that Ammon Bundy believes that his mission is to, quote, make the refuge into some sort of New Jerusalem. The parallels between Ammon and John Brown grow creepier by the minute. Others apparently view this as an opportunity for suicide by Fed, acting out whatever private demons they have pursuing them. Boil all of this down, and this is what we have left as our own demands, our own declaration, if you will. Number one, put the feds on notice that as much as we disagree with the actions of these people, that the government has an absolute duty to see that the situation ends without violence. In the case of the Freeman, that took 81 days and involved outside negotiators, at least one of whom, Kirk Lyons, was a federal informant. That's the other thing. You got to imagine that, these guys are just putting out an open call there for hey, everybody come join us. We need all the patriots to come join us in this place, strangers on the internet. Get your guns and come join us in this building. You got to figure there's a Fed or two in there.
Oh, well, they couldn't turn the internet off around the building, you know?
Well, that's the other thing, too. I mean, even aside from the threats of force, I mean, I've got to figure that this thing does not, the federal government can certainly, cut off their supplies, right? They'll just cut off the electricity. They cut off the internet. They can, jam the cell signals if they want to. And that'll more or less be the end of these guys. They'll just be like, hey, I'm thirsty, and then eventually they'll just come walking out.
Yep.
Number three, we must insist that some outside negotiators try to work out a compromise between the occupiers and the authorities to facilitate a peaceful end to the standoff. Of course, this time it would be preferable if none of those negotiators was a federal snitch. Number four, we must declare that the founders always looked upon the armed citizenry as the ultimate guarantors of liberty and safety, and that by making these demands, we are entirely consistent with their vision of a constitutional republic of limited powers and rule of law. We are prisoners of our principles as originally enunciated by them. As much as we disagree with the occupiers and whatever motives they may have, we cannot do otherwise. No more free Waco. So that was, as the caller mentioned, this is at Sipsey Street Irregulars. No more free Waco's, a national 3% declaration regarding the situation in Harney County. And, these guys, I think this is where the 3% thing came up with, and the theme behind that, if you're not familiar, is that approximately 3% of the, the colonists fought in the first American Revolution. They say, you get another 3%, we'll do this all over again.
I just want to, it's bugging me a little. I want to just correct the man on saying to not lose the moral high ground, no more Fort Sumter. Fort Sumter was a reaction to Lincoln putting a naval blockade on three of his own states in order to collect the tariffs.
Oh, well, there's been some claims that it's like a false flag attack too, right? That they're like, maybe you bombed your own fucking fort and is an excuse to come after us. I mean, the idea that you're waiting for the government to strike the first blow I mean, the government struck the first blow when the first American tax collector was hired, you know? The government struck the first blow when George Washington signed the law authorizing the first bank of the United States. The government struck the first blow when John Adams signed the Alien and Sedition Acts. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on. It's not as if the United States federal government hasn't been, you know, operating outside of its constitutional boundaries, killing motherfuckers. I mean, Whiskey Rebellion, ladies and gentlemen, you know, stepping outside of constitutional boundaries, killing people, doing things that it's not allowed to do, and all manner of abuses. The idea that you're waiting for the happening is kind of ridiculous. I sort of had that conversation with another caller prior. 218-936-0815 or Radical Agenda on a Skype set. Let's see here. Should we continue with this? I just want to take a short break. If you don't mind, just stand by for a minute. Ryan, you're not going to hear this, but the audience is going to hear. I'll play the audio clip from the video I put out earlier on this story.
All right.
In Oregon, Rumors of Wars by Christopher Cantwell, originally published at ChristopherCantwell.com, January 4th, 2016. Right now, an estimated 150 men occupy a building at Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Harney County, 30 miles south of Burns, Oregon. In defiance of federal authorities, a self-described militia vows to occupy the building and land for years to come and is purportedly prepared to fight to defend it. The standoff comes as the latest escalation in a decades-long conflict between ranchers in the area and two federal bureaucracies. The Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have long been buying up land in the area and becoming increasingly belligerent toward landowners who refuse to sell. In 2014, this culminated in an armed standoff between federal authorities and various self-described patriot groups at a ranch owned by Clive and Bundy, and ended, for the time being, with the retreat of federal agents. Organized by Clive and Bundy's son, Amon Bundy, the militiamen claimed to stand in defense of the Hammond family, whom the federal government has persecuted for decades over their refusal to sell. The Hammonds have been subjected to perpetual harassment and threats, hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines, months in federal prison, and today Dwight and Stephen Hammond are expected to turn themselves in to serve a 5-year minimum sentence over the absurd claim that their efforts to extinguish a fire was terrorism. The precise details of what led up to the present standoff will be beyond the scope of this post, as they are quite numerous and happened over the course of decades. The conservativetreehouse.com has put together an excellent timeline of events for those wishing to have a fuller comprehension of the nature of the conflict. Oath Keepers has also released a statement, and I would encourage everyone to read them both. Few seem to truly understand the particularly cruel treatment these fine folks have suffered, or the righteous frustration of the men Twitter liberals have mockingly dubbed Y'al-Qaeda. This is hardly surprising, however, since liberals are not exactly known for their capacity to understand complex subjects. Suffice to say, for our purposes, the federal government is acting, as it often does, as a belligerent aggressor operating outside of its purported constitutional boundaries. The entire case stinks of corruption and deceit, and all decent people should be grossly offended by it. I dare say I have a great deal of sympathy for the men who occupy the refuge. That men would rise in armed rebellion against federal authorities comes to me as neither aberrant nor abhorrent. Far from it. The federal government stands guilty of crimes far greater than the one inspiring this particular standoff, and so if there is anything to be said of insurrection, it is only that it is long overdue. I will, over the coming paragraphs, express some disillusionment with the particular actions of the militiamen in question. I will thusly advise against joining them. But this is due in no part to any aversion toward violence. Quite the contrary, I rather find their purported willingness to fight and die a very hopeful thing indeed. My objections come merely as a disapproval of resource allocation. If these men are prepared to lay down their lives in a fight against a tyrannical government, I would think it quite the malinvestment to see those lives snuffed out or spent in cages while so much work remains to be done. Our collective struggle to break the chains that bind us requires such men to stand ready to win meaningful battles. Sadly, it would appear to me they are on a course for mere martyrdom. That course will yield, at best, a Pyrrhic propaganda victory as the bodies of would-be soldiers are dragged off by the enemy and their weapons removed from the battlefield. Though the Malheur occupiers stand in greater numbers, it is not as if we haven't seen such martyrs lose their lives in the past. Jared and Amanda Miller, Justin Burke, Carl Draga, McVeigh, Waco, Ruby Ridge, just to name a few. There is no evidence to suggest that adding more bodies to the pile will improve anything. The evidence, in fact, stands in direct contravention of the notion. What has in fact occurred is ever more rapidly expanding government and an ever more subdued populace who dare not incur the wrath of their federal overlords. While force is irrefutably in order. Senseless suicide missions of this variety incur a great deal more cost to the cause of liberty than they do to the state apparatus. Suicide missions have proven effective only with Muslim savages who mercilessly slaughter the innocent because the random and frequent occurrence of such attacks strike fear not into the state, but into the populace. When the populace makes impossible security demands of the state apparatus, an ever-increasing government burden visits misery upon the entire civilization while incurring minimal cost to the enemy. While Western resistance fighters may rightly feel more ethical in their martyrdom by avoiding casualties amongst non-combatants, they simultaneously incur all of the costs, result in the same misery, and gain none of the benefits of suicide attacks carried out by foreign foes. Thusly, any perceived benefit to such actions are, to say the least, dubious in the extreme. Add to this that the standoff comes perhaps only hours before Barack Obama announces executive orders further restricting access to firearms for Americans, and one, if inclined towards conspiracy theories, might even begin to question the motives of the occupiers. In this vein, I would add, armslist.com, one of the more widely used online venues for private firearm sales, is down for maintenance at a time when demands for its services are almost certainly at an all-time high. Without question, men who are willing to fight and die for a cause are highly valuable. Even if their actions are terribly misguided, their intentions and capacity for sacrifice are things to be admired. Sadly, I fear poor leadership of these men threatens to squander that value. Put simply, 150, 1,500, or even 15,000 men gathered in a singular location, removed from the civilian populace and attempting to wage a war against the government of the United States is an act so frivolous it escapes rational comprehension. If one is prepared to die fighting his oppressor, dying is the easy part. Any idiot can get himself shot to death. Exacting a toll on the enemy in the process is a tad bit more difficult. That requires strategy, leadership, and effort, all of which seem to be sorely lacking in this standoff. Those who wish to strike a blow and make meaningful social and political change in the world would be a far greater service by prolonging their lives, concentrating geographically, acquiring material resources, and recruiting more bodies to the fight. Senselessly awaiting slaughter in the name of a cause that few people have the capacity to understand amounts to little more than self-immolation and is about as likely to restore the Republic as the San Bernardino shooting was to establish a caliphate. Okay, so I put that out earlier today. If you want to catch that video, the title of it is In Oregon, Rumors of War. And what I should have done, and I apologize, I'm going to ask you to hold on just a moment longer there, Rye. I wanted to play... I did a brief live broadcast last night about this, but I was having audio problems, unfortunately, and so I ended up scrapping the video. I want to play for you this clip that Augustus Invictus had put out. Now, I've had Augustus on the program before, and I like the guy. I think he's well intentioned. He's running for the United States Senate in Florida on the libertarian line. And we had him on here as a guest, and, you know, a lot of people came after him like he was some kind of fucking supervillain, fascist, Nazi fucking collaborator or some nonsense, because he had, like, some of the imagery on his campaign logo or whatever. And it was fucking nonsense. People came after him like he was some kind of fucking villain. And that's not the case. That's not what happened with Augustus at all. But he put this piece out, and somebody had posted it into the Radical Agenda listeners group on Facebook, which, by the way, if you want to join it, go ahead and send me an email at christophercantwell.com/contact before you try to join it, because I screen people from the group. So let me play this, and I want to address what Augustus is saying here.
Good evening, friends. The new year is here, and with it, rebellion. Earlier today, a group of armed men stormed a federal building in Oregon. Beyond that, everything is speculation. Everything is spin. Were there 6 men or 150? Are their aims vicious or noble? Was this action symbolic, or did they intend an act of war? In the year 1919, armed men stormed a post office in Dublin, Ireland. Thusly began the Easter Rising. Most of its leaders were executed, and the rebellion was an utter failure, but only in the short term. The longer consequences are the more important, and I guarantee that the leaders of the Easter Rising would agree. Their example inspired the Revolutionary Republic, and their sacrifice to this day sings to us in heroic voice. We may not agree that the ranchers' complaints against the federal government are the most dire or the most worthy of taking up arms. But we can, if nothing else, see in them an example. What does it matter whether they are fighting for their family members and neighbors, or whether they are fighting for the abstract concept of property rights? Are we not all American citizens and all outraged by the overreach of the federal government? Listen, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Those of you who insist on belittling the folks in Oregon because they have no master plan for revolution, or because you find their objectives to be silly form or nonsense, or because they are not as well-versed in political philosophy as you, you are worse than the sheep who swallow what the media reports without question. You, who have been talking about the overreach of the federal government for years, are now berating the people who are actually doing something about it. So get off your high horse, quit your juvenile internet commentary, and support your fellow citizens in their struggle against tyranny. History will judge you not by the bite of your sarcastic witticisms on Facebook, but by your actions and by your sacrifices.
Okay, so he goes on for another minute in this clip here, but that's basically what I wanted to get at. I'm not under the impression that Augustus is in his car right now on his way to go get fucking murdered by the federal government in Oregon, okay? And I would not advise that of any of you either. You know, when I came out on Facebook and I mentioned I do not advise anybody to go to this thing, a lot of people contacted me when this thing popped off, like, hey, what do you think of that? We've talked about the violent overthrow of government on this program more than once. And, you know, yeah, it's an egregious situation going on out there. There's no question about it. But I did not think that this was something that I would want to advise any of you to go and put yourselves in danger over. I hope that Augustus really makes something of himself. I hope that he builds up a following and that people start, you know, listening to what he says and taking what he says seriously. And when that happens, I hope that he comes to understand that when you have that kind of power, that you have to wield it fucking responsibly. If you go out and you tell people, if you stir people to bloody riot and revolution, and they go out to a place that's likely full of feds and go get themselves fucking whacked in a drone strike or some other kind of madness, right? You know, whatever the intentions of the people who started this thing off, there's no way in hell that that's a safe situation out there. There's no way in hell that they're going to strike a real blow against the powers of the federal government. So, you know, for anybody to go and encourage you to go put yourself in danger out there is a ridiculously irresponsible thing to do. And I don't encourage anybody to do it. And with that, welcome back to the program, Ryan Dawson.
Yeah. Well, if they're not there themselves, then don't listen to them encouraging you to do it or anyone else to do it.
Yeah, that's the other thing too. And you know, the truth of the matter is if, you know, if these guys all go and, you know, end up dead, believe me, I'll try to go make a propaganda piece out of this, okay? That, hey, they fought for the right thing and then the government killed them. That's terrible. You know, I mean, I'll do that, right? If I had woken up to the story of these guys tried to do this and the feds came in and whacked them, I mean, I've got stories up on the website of different guys who have fought, you know, fought against government agents, got themselves killed or whatever. And after the fact, I'll go and I'll make a martyr out of them, right? But the idea that you're going to encourage people to go down to that place, you know, it just seems, you know, incredibly irresponsible to me.
Yeah, I mean, as much as you'd want to have a physical takeover of the government, you have to be pragmatic and look at the real situation. You're gonna lose and badly. You're just outarmed.
Yeah, I mean, that's ultimately the problem there. I mean, I'm all for whatever it takes to solve some of the problems that we've got in our civilization. I mean, we're on the verge of, you know, Obama coming down with executive orders on gun control, bypassing Congress yet again. The list of egregious violations by the government of the United States and its various subdivisions, you know, are too long to list. You know, in the time it takes us to do this program, the government will victimize more people than I could possibly enumerate if I did this show 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In 2 hours, they'll, you know, make more constitutional violations than I could ever possibly hope to enumerate. And the idea that, you know, we're all going to go get ourselves fucking whacked every time that happens is crazy. It was a major egregious violation what happened to these folks out there. It's ridiculous to try to, you know, convict them on terrorist charges for putting out a fucking fire. But you know what? It's egregious every time they, you know, go throw somebody in prison for the rest of their life because they had a fucking meth lab too. But, you know, I'll be fucked if I'm going to go turn around, get myself killed every time some meth lab gets busted. Okay. War on drugs, not my favorite of government policies, But, you know, it's, and of course it's a, you know, as far as the Constitution goes, if the war on drugs, were constitutional, then they wouldn't have needed the 18th Amendment to start alcohol prohibition or the 21st Amendment to repeal it. It's totally outside of the federal government's, you know, boundaries as evidenced by its own amendments. But, you know, we're not gonna go out and get ourselves fucking whacked, every time they go out and, you know, make some kind of drug bust. I also wanted to play real quick, and again, you're going to hear a little silence here, Rye, but I'll bring you right back on. Here's Stuart Rhodes talking about the situation. Stuart Rhodes, founder and president of Oath Keepers.
This is Stuart Rhodes, founder and president of Oath Keepers. I want to make a comment about the Hammond situation in Oregon. Something most folks, I don't think, understand is that the Hammond family has declined help. In fact, is making it very clear they do not want any kind of a standoff with the feds, and they do not want to try to prevent themselves from going and serving their sentence out. They intend to turn themselves in and serve out the remainder of their sentence. This has been made clear by their own attorney. We've also made it very clear that Aaron Bundy does not speak for them. Now, why this has to be said is that, unfortunately, Ammon has not made that clear. He has put out a statement just last couple days calling for people to go there and defend the family. He says here, I'm asking you now to come to Burns and defend this family and defend this county. But he's not making it clear that the Hammond family does not want that done. They wanted to just turn themselves in and go serve their sentence. It'd be much like in the Kim Davis situation. We offered her our assistance, our protection against the U.S. Marshals for being able to arrest her again under contempt orders from the court. We thought that was illegitimate. We offered our protection, and we were willing to go there with rifles in hand and stop them. But she declined our offer. Through her attorneys, she let it be known that she did not want our help. So we stood down and went home. We do not have the right to force ourselves on people who do not want our help. So that's ground zero on this. They have not asked for our help. In fact, quite the contrary, they've let it be known they just want to go turn themselves in and serve out their sentence. So we have no right, none of us do, no patriot has any right to force a confrontation around that family when they don't want it. So to me, that's a no-brainer and should be the end of the discussion. Now, beyond that, there's also some very serious differences in this case and at Bundy Ranch. We went to Bundy Ranch to prevent that family from being Waco'd. We were concerned by the behavior of the feds with their special forces contractors and their known sniper teams they were deploying against cowboys and the free speech zone they set up and all that kind of abuse that was right there in front of us on camera. We were concerned this family was about to be Waco'd. And so it was a very righteous thing to go down there and prevent that. And that was our full justification for what we did, was to go there and prevent mass murder of his family. I think that was righteous, and I'm glad we did it. Even though there were some problems that came out of that, it was worth it. But this situation here, there's no threat of the family being murdered. There's been already a jury trial. They were found guilty by a jury that appears. And so, and you don't have local support. You've got, in fact, locals now standing up and saying they don't want anybody from outside coming in and interfering, and the family themselves don't want the help. So this is exactly the opposite of Bundy Ranch. You've got a situation where you've got people who don't want this, and you've got outsiders trying to force it on them. So I think we need to stay out of it. If it's only a matter of peaceful protest, of course, that'd be fine. That's righteous and good to go. But you cannot go there and force a confrontation with rifles in hand when the family does not want the assistance. So I think Oath Keepers need to stay the hell out of it, aside from a peaceful protest. But that's not what I see developing. In Ammon's own video statement, he talks about calling on those who went to Bundy Ranch to go there to Oregon and take a stand in defense of the family. It does not sound like a peaceful protest. That sounds like an armed confrontation. So Ammon needs to be clear about what he wants so people know what they're getting themselves into. So far, he has not been clear. But Oath Keepers will not be involved in an armed standoff that's being manufactured by potheads who want a fight, because this is going to be a bad fight, not a righteous, moral high ground fight. Stay out of it. So now I've got a couple other people here who are at Bundy Ranch.
Okay, so you know, there we go. I've gotten, I think that'll do it for the recordings of other people on the subject. That's Stuart Rhodes, founder and president of Oath Keepers. You know, he says these guys are weed heads. You know, I don't want to follow them into a fucking war. The family that they claim to be defending wants nothing to do with this stuff, and this is Ammon Bundy. saying, hey, come out and, you know, start a fucking war with me. And, you know, they're not having it. Now, the actual numbers of people out there, not entirely clear, but, you know, that's more or less about the information that we have on the subject. So anything else you want to add to this before we move on, Rye?
I just wonder how much money the federal government is going to get thrown into all the different bureaus involved with this, just because they can go, aha, look at this minor insignificant threat taking over basically an empty building. We need more funding. We need more money and agents, and that'll be happening. And it's just amazing to me that you have such a stink over what is pretty much a small manner when you and the U.S. isn't bothered about, oh, I don't know, giving F-16s and F-15s to Saudi Arabia to bomb the hell out of Yemen and murder people. That doesn't matter.
Well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, these guys
are grazing going... rights for cattle. That's the issue.
Right. Exactly. That'll be, you know. I mean, I'll tell you what. I mean, if that's what sparks the fucking next civil war, you know, I will certainly stand corrected. I just think it's kind of unlikely. 218-936-0815 or Radical Agenda on Skype. Rye, what's your bit? I mean, you've got the YouTube channel there. You've been making videos for a while. What's going on with you lately?
I mean, I cover international news most of the time. I'm very highly anti-Zionist. I'm a libertarian as well, / anarchist at points. I don't know. I flip-flop there. I think sometimes we need a government, but, the American one is very dysfunctional, and I've been covering the presidential elections, but mainly I've gotten to the point like George Carlin where I feel like I got a front row seat to, you know, watch everything go down the drain. I've been getting pretty cynical, but, you know, my mood flips from time to time, but yeah, I've been making feature films and, covering what's been going on in Syria, what happened in Iraq. I did films on, September 11th attacks, and no, it's not Alex Jones cuckoo stuff like that either, but, a lot of topics, but now and then it's just fun to make fun of it all.
So I went through a few of your videos before I had you on here, and I mean you made some commentary on the Syrian refugee situation. Why don't you summarize your ideas on that right quick?
Yeah, I did that, and also on why, you know, there was so much more coverage of the attacks in France versus some other places. I mean, people neglected to acknowledge that France itself is a major media power in the world, and of course it's going to cover itself, and that's why they're going to have more coverage than Beirut or Nigeria, etc. I mean, you know, they're not covering things in other places. I doubt Nigeria or Beirut did any stories about the protests in Okinawa. You know, I mean, the Western media, that it covers things at all is something. But for Syrian refugees, you know, you've got, one, they're not, the refugee crisis is not all Syrians. I mean, it's labeled like that, but that's not how it is. And, you know, they've been refugees for a very long time, and there are a lot of refugees from Syria and Turkey, and now suddenly out of the blue, they need to be released and absorbed into Europe. And, you know, a lot of leftists will say, like, well, we just have to accept all these people. And some people on the right will go, well, we care about them, but what if terrorists come along embedded with them and it's just going to cause problems? That regardless, it's just not a sustainable solution. It's people starting the story in the middle. If you want to stop the or correct the refugee crisis, and it is a problem, then you have to resolve the problems that are creating refugees in the first place, mainly having our intelligence agencies allying with Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra groups, and even ISIS through Turkey and other factions like Saudi Arabia. I mean, we wouldn't have these refugees, economic or otherwise, if we didn't have the IMF out there strapping Northern Africa with predatory loans on purpose. Then you wouldn't have so many African migrants. You wouldn't have so many war-torn areas if you weren't involved with fucking with them all the time. So if we don't resolve those policies, and in America, if we don't reform things like NAFTA, which although it has free trade in the title, has nothing to do with free trade, then there, of course there are going to be illegal immigrants. If you can constantly entice people with all these social benefits, then yeah, I mean, it's like leaving cheese out for mice. I mean, of course they're going to come, but we do not have the economic capacity to absorb so many people. It's just not a sustainable situation.
I don't disagree with what you've laid out there. I mean, the foreign policy of the United States and, you know, a lot of the trade policies you mentioned, you know, NAFTA. I mean, if you have a free trade agreement, the free trade agreement can be done inside of a single paragraph. It's like, okay, we will not put tariffs, you know, we will have free trade, you know, these trade agreements are like thousands of pages long. Nobody fucking understands them. And it's just many pages of regulation. It's not free trade at all. It's actually heavily fucking regulated.
It's corporate welfare, really, because you have these giant government subsidized agro businesses moving into Mexico with their, you know, volume discount and pushing out the farmers. And of course, that's why you have this stereotype of the fruit pickers coming to Florida and Texas or whatever, because they've been pushed off of where they formerly were. But how are they supposed to compete with, you know, government subsidized corporate welfare on one side, whereas they have to actually sell their produce to make profit on the other? There's nothing fair or free about that.
Well, I imagine that I don't imagine that you would have what do you call them? I made the case prior that, I mean, even aside from whatever they're doing in these other places, that you have you know, the artificially high minimum wages, that you have the that you have the welfare benefits and this sort of thing, and these are economic signals, right? You're saying, if wages are high, that's an indication that that there's a high demand for labor in a given area. When you set your minimum wage, and now we just had you know, the new year is here, and as of the new year, 14 states in the U.S. are raising their minimum wage. You know, if you have artificially high wages, then that is an economic signal, and people are saying, oh, well, there's high wages over there. And if they come to a place and they don't get a job, then they're paid anyway through the welfare system. And these economic signals just keep on putting it out there like, hey, come here, come here, come here, come here. And people respond to that. And it's kind of ridiculous to think that they want it, right? So, I mean, if you're in, you know, living in Mexico or fucking Nigeria or any one of these, you know, shitholes, and there's a whole bunch of money to be made, you know, people are going to do that. I mean, even if you're not tearing their fucking country apart, I mean, some of these people, I'm sorry to say, are not doing good in their own countries because the people in their countries are fucking shit, right? When you see these fucking lunatics come pouring across the borders into Europe, where they, you know, they go, you know, they find themselves, oh, we're refugees. They find themselves in Turkey or, you know, any number of places, and they say, no, we've got to get to Germany. We've got to get to England. We've got to get to Italy because they've got the generous welfare states. And they're like, no, we want the money. We want the money.
Yeah, specifically, I mean, and like for in Sweden, for example, people are walking there because the Swedes have said, okay, you can come here as refugees, but you can't fly here because they won't allow any visas. So you can come here, but you're going to have to take a raft and swim and go across Greece and this and that and this and that. It's a ploy, you know, and they're spending so much more to do that. It's just, it's a way of undermining your own populace. They can use refugees as a weapon and economically, and it is being done. And that's something that's gone on for a long time. But the Syrians, the actual Syrians fleeing from war, of course, I feel for them. I understand they need somewhere to be other than Syria because they're risking their lives. But why do they have to go all the way to the UK or specifically to Germany, et cetera? This is because they're seeking the economic benefits that they believe they can get in those areas. It's not just to survive or to better themselves, or like getting a better job. That's sometimes what's considered a refugee, is people just looking for better wages somewhere. And what you mentioned about raising minimum wages, that's just pricing a lot of people out of the market. I mean, the wages are what they are because the person that's hired has to produce more than what they take in wages. Otherwise, the person hiring them isn't making a profit. And when you slap on 22 to 30% corporate profit taxes, you know, that's a third of their wealth going down the drain, going to the government that spends it on all these fucking wars that cause the refugees and problems to begin with. It's a vicious circle.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous disaster. You mentioned Sweden. Last night I recorded an episode of Red Ice Radio. And that's a podcast that records in Sweden with a guy by the name of Henrik. That ought to be out in the next couple of days. Usually they put those recordings off for a little while. He said he's going to put mine out sooner, so I should have a link up to that in the pretty near future. And you know, he's over there in Sweden and talking about you know, the situation over there. We'll probably have him on the program in the near future. So look forward to that. 218-936-0815 or Radical Agenda on Skype. As we go back to the phones, 480, you're on the Radical Agenda. What's your agenda?
Oh, hey, Chris. Sorry, buddy. Please put me on hold. Just listen to your show.
No, you can't. I can't let you. You got to use the TuneIn app, okay? If you're trying to listen from your smartphone, then use the TuneIn app for smartphone because this is a automated interface. I can't like figure out what you're trying to do. I'm sorry. 218-936-0815. The Radical Agenda on Skype. You guys are calling into the conference line to like listen to the podcast. If you're trying to listen on your phone, I've got the TuneIn app. Go to ChristopherCampbell.com.
Three more people do that in a row so we can hear him pop.
No. Well, it's the same guy is what it is. And like, I know, I'm sorry, you know. And I appreciate that the guy really wants to listen to the show, but it's a distraction that I can't, I'm a one-man operation. It's not like I have a board op to figure this out for me. I'm sorry, go ahead. What was that?
I'm just saying, tune in. That's how you get around it. If you have a smartphone, use tune in as the application, and there you go.
Yeah, exactly. And we've got, whenever I post the blog posts on ChristopherCampbell.com announcing the shows, I give you the link to the live feed, everything else. So, you know, you can put it in VLC or any number of things. There's plenty of ways to listen to this program. If you're in the car or whatever, and it'll go through your Bluetooth, whatever you want to do. But unfortunately, doing it through the phone, this ain't Free Talk Live. Free Talk Live is the thing where you can listen to it over the phone. And maybe one of these days I'll figure that out, but we're not there yet. So 218-936-0815, or Radical Agenda on Skype is the number to call in if you would like to be a guest on the program. Not if you would like to listen to it. So I'm sorry to that, gentleman. You'll just have to pick up the podcast, on iTunes or Stitcher or Podcast Addict or whatever you want, later on. So let me go to, what else we got here? There was a lot to actually get to, and we're getting close to the end of the program, but let me pull up my bookmarks here. Oh, you know what's becoming a real problem? There's a big terrorism problem over in, Israel there. And as is the case with so many things, you know what the problem is? It's the Jews.
They're pigeons.
Fundamentalist Jewish terror, a growing threat to Israel, says experts. Young, fearless, rebellious, idealistic, and militant. These are some of the words security experts use to describe a growing terror threat facing Israel. But they are not referring to Islamist extremism. They're talking about hardline Jewish settlers called the Hilltop Youth. Now, in case you think that I'm reading this to you from the Occidental Observer or some alt-right blog that just hates the Jews, this is coming from NBC News. That's where I'm pulling this from.
The Hilltop are the jackasses that burned a baby alive a few months ago, and they still haven't been resentenced. 6 months in jail, cushy jail, for burning a baby, and then they also killed a 3-year-old, and the mother died of her wounds too, and I think the father also died. There was only one child that survived that attack. And that was after burning a Christian church on top of that. And no real prosecutions, and no real condemnation. Even Bibi said it was bad, but you know, what they say and what they do are very different. What they did was basically let them off.
That's fascinating. I found this and I was completely unaware of it. I mean, I'm not entirely hip to the whole Jew conspiracy thing. A lot of my alt-right friends are, you know, getting on my case. I got to read Culture of Critique, which I try to get into probably after, Hoppe's Democracy, the God That Failed, which I'm in the middle of here. But, so they burned a fucking baby, huh? Did they at least kiss its penis first? Or what was the routine with that?
They did not give it herpes, by sucking off its, fucking foreskin or whatever. No, they just burned it. They set the houses on fire and it ended up killing basically a whole family and including a baby, and laughed about it in court. And only
was it a Jewish family, or were they like killing Palestinians, or what was their routine?
They were killing Palestinians in the West Bank.
Oh, so of course, the Israeli government was like, all right, fine, go kill some Palestinians, right?
Can you imagine if Palestinians had burned a Jewish house and killed a Jewish baby? I mean, it would have been blamed on Iran and we would have war already.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that such a thing has happened once or twice. I mean, they do like to launch some rockets into there once in a while. Which is why Israel doesn't have the open borders, right?
Israel's building a wall that's not even on their border that cuts into Palestine and actively annexes land. Of course they fire rockets at them because they're starving to death and having their houses demolished. But what would anyone else do if we just took an area of the United States and said, you know what, we're just going to take these bulldozers and start knocking your houses down? I mean, we're flipping out of our grazing rights. Imagine if we just got some armored vehicles and just went in and smashed entire cities and towns and racially replaced them like colonization style. It's just, would never happen, but that happens in Israel all the time.
Well, I am not under the impression that Israel has been kind to the Palestinians over there. My my assessment of that situation is there ain't no good guys involved, right? I mean, I don't particularly think, you know, maybe that'll bring me over to something back from your YouTube channel as I was preparing to have you.
Yeah,
on.
They're not good guys, but it's a perfectly predictable consequence of their behavior. I mean, the reason you had kamikazes in Japan was because they were attacking them. The reason you had suicide bombers in Vietnam was because of the occupation. The same thing in Iraq, same thing in Iran. You didn't have them before the occupation. You only have them during and after.
I don't know about that with Muslims, though. I mean, you know, with Muslims, it would seem to me that these people are blowing themselves all the fucking time, right? I don't know that this is entirely I'm not ready to. Don't get me wrong. I'm not an advocate of the U.S. foreign policy or the state of Israel. I'm not advocating for either of these things. But I've got to say, I think that when your fucking religious ideology tells you that the best way to get to heaven is to blow yourself the fuck up and kill the fucking infidel, that might provide a certain incentive to do that sort of thing.
Well, I don't think that's interpretation of the religion catches on without a military occupation. That's what I was saying. Like a lot of areas of the world that are Muslim, Indonesia, et cetera, are not having those kind of problems. It's only the places that have military occupations. That's why I brought up Vietnam and Japan. They're neither country are Muslim. Yet you still had suicide bombers, kamikaze from Japan because they were trying to protect Japan from getting annihilated, which it ended up getting annihilated anyway. You had suicide bombings in Vietnam because of the military occupation. You had suicide bombings when Iraq and Iran fought each other, which you've never had before because of the desperate situation. It wasn't just from the religion. It's from occupation, as Ron Paul had pointed out, too.
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to suggest that the occupations have nothing to do with it. But you mentioned Indonesia, and I'm going to tell you, no, you're wrong. That there is fucking terrorist problems in Indonesia. I've got a story here from the Sydney Morning Herald. Okay, Indonesia arrests three with suspected links to Islamic State amid terror alert. Indonesian police on Thursday arrested three men with suspected links to the Islamic State as part of an operation in the province of Central Sulawesi to capture the country's most wanted man, state media reported. The arrests came as U.S. Embassy in Jakarta issued an emergency message for U.S. citizens warning of potential security threats at tourist beaches on the island of Lombok surrounding the New Year's Eve celebrations. Counterterrorism officials believe there are at least 1,000 sympathizers of the radical jihadist group across Indonesia. More than a dozen men suspected of planning bomb attacks over the holiday period were arrested in a series of raids recently, and the hunt is on for their ringleaders. You know, the story.
Right, it's not a suicide bombing, and the Islamic State is a recent creation from 2011 onward. I mean, you've got you always get suicide bombings from the pressure of military occupations, whether it's Muslim or not. You're going to get the same result, people killing themselves trying to kill you. I mean, you had just as much violence during the Iran-Contra in Nicaragua and Catholic countries in Latin America with people beheading each other and child soldiers and rape and murder and all that all throughout. You had it in Grenada, you had it in Nicaragua, you had it in Guatemala. Same thing with Christians. It didn't really matter. And it wasn't part of their Christianity either. It was because of the drug trade and cartels and pressure from military occupations.
Well, I'd be the last one to deny that there's a lot of bad things that happen as a result of drug raids and occupations. But I have a hard time, I do not believe for a heartbeat that the Christians and the Muslims are behaving in the same way, right? I mean, if you want to point me to something, if you've got a story that you want to pull up or something like that, I'd be interested to hear it.
30,000 people killed in Nicaragua during the Civil War. I mean,
a bunch of people got killed in a civil war. This doesn't surprise me, but I'm going to say that, you know, the idea that they're operating in the same manner seems far-fetched.
Well, I mean, what barbarity did one do that the other hasn't done?
I mean, I'm asking you to tell me. I mean, if you're just asserting that Catholics do the exact same things as Muslims, I'm challenging the notion, and I'm asking you to provide me with information other than a bunch of people wound up dead. It was a war, don't get me wrong. A war, people die, right? So I'm not surprised that there was a war and then a bunch of people wound up dead. But sort of the decapitations, the sex slavery, these sort of things, the fucking selling off Yazidi chicks to jihadi fighters and this sort of thing, seems to me that it is of a different variety than we see with Christian fighters in other places. Is that, do you perceive that to be inaccurate in some way?
No, I think the poorer the places and the closer you get to the equator, you usually end up with more violence, but we have it on both sides in both hemispheres with different religions. And there's sex slavery everywhere. There's sex slavery all throughout, from Brazil to Russia. Of course, it's all through Africa and the Middle East too, but it's not particular to any religion. A lot of sex trafficking comes from Israel, actually.
Well, I'm not surprised to find out that there are criminal organizations that do things, and I know all too well about the scandals within the Catholic Church. But at least it's usually kept underground, right? Like these are elements that are operating at least auspiciously without the permission of the leaders of the group, right? That they are going out and they're doing things that are not permitted. Whereas ISIS goes out and says, hey, yes, of course we're enslaving the Yazidi women. Here's the part of the book that says that we're supposed to do this.
Sure. I mean, there's really nothing on the level of ISIS in modern times. But organized crime anywhere behaves in the same way, but they usually do try and hide it. You have a point there, whereas ISIS just brags about it openly and he says, yeah, we're doing this. What have you?
Yeah, I mean that is what I think is, you know, kind of the foundational difference there. Let's go to the phone. We've got Socrates trying to get on via Skype. Socrates, you're on the Radical Agenda. What's your agenda?
Well, I'm surprised you got have Ry Dawson on. I haven't heard of him for a while. Ry, I never spoke to you before. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good. This is fun.
Oh yeah, let me kind of direct this question both of you. Now, Chris, I kind of gave you shit before, kind of if we should classify Jewish people as a race that isn't white, you know. But let me ask Ry that question, because he kind of does have this this idea, like he attacks Alex Jones for a lot for, you know, blaming everything on Saudi Arabia.
For blaming the Freemason, kind of, Illuminati, the Bavarian death cult, NWO, criminal elements.
But yeah, right, but I mean, that's sick though, right? I mean, that's how, like, he gets really pissed off and he yells and, it, like, he makes some good points.
He's a disinformation well. He poisons the well. He makes the topic of 9/11 act like it's just something for lunatics. And he's told people their light bulbs are going to kill you. He was the one that blabbed on about Fukushima radiation forever. He told everybody Ebola was going to go airborne and kill 80% of the population. He said celebrities were fleeing to leave in bunkers in New Zealand based on a story of James Cameron moving in a house in New Zealand. He's a fucking idiot.
Point taken.
Okay.
Let me give my question to both of you and Chris here. Okay, so do you find then that Alex Jones really just kind of makes an enemy out of the Jewish conspiracy type people? So I was curious if you kind of put yourself into that group.
Well, I don't like the Jewish conspiracy people either. I mean, Zionism is a political ideology, and of course there are racist Jews. I mean, they're racist whatever from anywhere, but the difference is Jewish racism is allowed to flower and foster because of Holocaust. I mean, they can do it, whereas other groups who would be socially unacceptable to behave that way, their kind of racial nepotism in banking and other industries is just perfectly accepted. Like other groups are allowed to be racist. And they definitely are a lot of racist Jews.
Basically, every group is allowed to be racist except for whites. I mean, we've gone over this how many times? I mean, everybody went fucking crazy because there was a billboard for a website, wherewhitepeoplemeet.com, and this was a big problem. But of course, there's black dating sites, Jewish dating sites, Muslim dating sites. It's only when you say, hey, white people, now we've got a problem.
So that leaves my next
question. I think you're going to ask if Jews are a race, right?
Yeah,
Anybody stupid enough to believe the lies of a rabbi is a Jew, religiously. Now, as far as having like an ethnic identity, there are a lot of people who think, well, I was related to somebody who's related to somebody who believed the lies in a rabbi, but Jews make up many different races. Most of the Jews that live in Israel came from Europe, and they have blue eyes, and they're just as white as other whites. But, you know, they don't really follow science. They just go with, well, if my mother's Jewish, I'm Jewish. But that's not how genes actually work.
Understood. So, but then they, why do they get the, yes, Chris just made a point. How come they get a pass for, like, being white, right? They're allowed to have Jewish people meet, right? You're like, everybody, and anything that you could say that's possibly against the, you know, mostly atheist government of Israel, right, is anti-Semitic. So, to me,
the mostly atheist government of Israel is a myth. Israel is Jewish. Israel's absolutely Jewish. The settlers are fanatically religious that are living in the West Bank. Fanatically religious. And they get a pass because of World War II. The U.S. has to have the Holocaust mythos to justify every war after it. I mean, you've got to have a new Hitler. That's how they justify the whole, the industry is involving billions and billions of dollars. And then they get away with it, even though they're such a minority, because you have leftist groups that automatically cling to anything, you know, of racial politics. They're going to side with whatever isn't white. I mean, like, that's just the default setting. And so they defend their racism. They defend their nepotism, not just for Jewish groups, but for all the groups. But, you know, there's really nothing like, see, people might ask, well, what about certain traits with the nose or ears or whatever? That's from inbreeding. That's what happens when you have groups, you know, fucking cousins enough times. You end up with those certain types of traits. But that's just, like, the noticeable ones. But, you know. I just
want to defend Chris's point then, really quick. There is a contrast, like, in terms of, like, the suicide bombers. I don't think you've ever seen a Buddhist suicide bomber in history. Now, points aside, you can definitely see that Sunni is a religion that, like, is an extremist religion, right, of Islam that is
Salafist, yeah.
Yeah, like, compare that to the Shiite Muslims in general, just in the past 50 years, right? I mean, I haven't seen Iran declare war on anybody in, what, 200 years? Right? There's sects of the Muslim religion that are inherently violent, and they're inherently going to blow shit up. And you have the government here taking advantage of it. All right, go ahead, Chris.
Unless you're Wahhabi Salafist out of Saudi Arabia, which has to support all that shit because they are a fucking monarchy, which is based on the belief. I mean, they have a fucking king, who's murdered 47 people recently, all of them Shiites. But that system of a monarchy is dependent on that type of faith. Whereas the majority of Muslims around the world don't have theocracies, don't have a monarchy, but Saudi Arabia has vested interest in keeping Salafism alive, which is where you get ISIS and all these fucks that chop off heads and kill babies and, you know, rape women and everything else. I mean, that is definitely a horrible religion, but that's Salafist Islam, not Islam in general. Well, I think any religion in general is fucking stupid too, but it's not violent.
I mean, some people have made the case that, if Christians stuck to the Bible, that they might be just as bad as the Muslims. And I don't think that that is entirely true. But it seems to me that far fewer other religious groups take their religion so seriously as to try to live their lives as if it were actually happening, right? I mean, if people really believe that they're going to, go to a fucking paradise after they die, I imagine that even if they don't kill themselves, that this would result in a lot of really dangerous and careless behavior, at the very least. I dropped Socrates' call, but I want to thank him very much for chiming in.
Yeah,
here.
Good questions.
We mentioned the Saudi thing, and I do want to get to this real quick. I mean, we're getting towards the end of the program, but Saudis cut ties with Iran following Shiite cleric execution. Saudi Arabia announced Sunday it was severing diplomatic relations with Shiite powerhouse Iran amid escalating tensions over the Sunni kingdom's execution of a prominent Shiite cleric. The move came hours after protesters stormed and set fire to the Saudi embassy in Tehran and followed harsh criticism by Iran's top leader of the Saudis' execution of Sheikh Nimer al-Nimer. Nimmer, whatever the fuck. Names over there. What the fuck is wrong with you people? My name is Sheikh Nimer al-Nimer. My name is Christopher. Saudi Foreign Minister Adel al-Jubeer said Iranian diplomatic personnel had 48 hours to leave his country, and all Saudi diplomatic personnel in Iran had been called home. The mass execution of al-Nimr and 46 others, the largest carried out by the Saudi Arabia in 3.5 decades, laid bare the sectarian divisions gripping the region as demonstrators took to the streets from Bahrain to Pakistan in protest. It also illustrated the kingdom's new aggressiveness under King Salman. During his reign, Saudi Arabia has led a coalition fighting Shiite rebels in Yemen and staunchly opposed regional Shiite power in Iran, even as Tehran struck a nuclear deal with world powers. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah al-Khamenei, warned Saudi Arabia on Sunday of divine revenge over al-Nimr's death, while Riyadh accused Tehran of supporting terrorism in a war of words that threatened to escalate even as the U.S. and European Union sought to calm the region. Al-Jubeer told a news conference in Riyadh that the Iranian regime has had, quote, a long record of violations of foreign diplomatic missions dating back to the occupation of the U.S. embassy in 1979, and such incidents constitute a flagrant violation of all international agreements, according to the official Saudi press agency.
They got room to talk.
You know, this is what I'm trying to get at with the Muslims, though, right? I'm saying to myself, I saw one of the videos on your channel there. You said, anti-Muslim rage is hypocritical or something like that. I gotta say, these people are fucking crazy. You know, like, I understand that U.S. foreign policy is not helping matters over there, but these guys are like, wait a second, you have a different religion than me, and I'm gonna cut your fucking head off, and we're gonna throw a party through the fucking streets over it, and there's gonna be, and then we'll have a war with this other country because some fucking asshole said some shit in a mosque somewhere, right? These people are fucking nuts, and that's a really good reason. I'm not saying it's a good reason. You know, I was skeptical of a lot of this shit because as a libertarian, I thought this was all war propaganda, right? I'm like, oh, it's just a bunch of people trying to get us to support the war, talking shit about the Muslims. Islam's the religion of peace and all this crap. And what I realize as I look at it is these people are batshit crazy, and that's a really good reason not to be at fucking war with them.
Well, it's certainly not a religion of peace. It's a religion is as religion does. It's up to the individual, can make the religion however they want. You've got varying degrees of Christians too, and Muslims and Jews. I mean, you've got Zionist Jews that were burning babies, and you have, you know, normal Jews that would never, ever, ever do something like that, of course. But the Saudi state is an exception. It is a monarchy. It is a theocracy supported by the theology of its religion. It has, like, Christianity used to have the divine right of kings too. That's how it was practiced for 1,800 years. Saudi Arabia, I mean, because of their oil and energy power, because of that, you've got these madras that are funded, these religious schools that bring up generations of kids brainwashed like this to be quote unquote fucking crazy. But I wouldn't paint the brush for Shiites and other groups, though, victims of this. I mean, ISIS has been killing who? A couple American journalists? The main victims of ISIS terrorism have been other Muslims and minority groups. And of course, some Christians and Druze have been killed too, but it's been Alawites and Kurds and even other non-radical Sunnis and Shiites that are getting killed. And I think that we've orientalized, the Middle East. And that's part of the agenda. I mean, that we want people to go, oh, fuck it, make it a glass parking lot, et cetera. But you should have a more nuanced position on it and see that, you know, Iran is a modern country. I mean, they're fighting in Saudi Arabia. Fuck Saudi Arabia. But it's the U.S. that is supporting religious fanatics. It's the U.S. supporting the Sunnis in Saudi Arabia. And it's the U.S. supporting the Zionists in Israel. Religious fanatics are our best friends because they cause conflicts. And the U.S. is all about selling weapons and causing conflicts.
Well, I still think that... I still don't think that it's inappropriate to be like, all right, I'm skeptical of this entire fucking religious group. I'm just going to say it there. But I agree with your assessment that the United States is certainly no stranger to stirring up fucking conflicts and thrives on this fucking crap. We're getting close to the end of the program. So where do people find out more about you, Rye?
Well, there's ANC report. That's the anti-neocon report. I have podcasts there, videos, et cetera. That's sort of the main hub that'll lead to everything else. Is the ANC report. And then there's my YouTube channel and stuff. If you Google up War by Deception, that's one of my most prominent or famous films, I guess, I made. I made a new one, but it's not for, it's only for purchase. So it's not for free, but
okay.
That's the most thing.
Right on. Well, we actually have two callers hanging on hold, so we'll get to them before we end the program here. 949, you are on the Radical Agenda. What's your agenda?
Hey guys, are you guys both believe in the petrodollar theory?
I don't.
Why don't you, for the listening audience, why don't you break down what the theory is?
Sure, okay. Well, because as dumb as government is, asking them, it must do something that makes a little bit of sense. And so the only thing that makes sense for us spending more than the entire world on our military is the petrodollar. I can think of no other reason why they would do that. And the only reason they can afford to spend so much more than all the other countries and why we can get oil at like half the cost, like most countries get it, is because all oil has to be priced in dollars. And so for those countries to obtain dollars, they have to have export economies. That's why all the Asia countries are based on export economies, because they need to get dollars so they can buy oil.
A lot of countries have already left the petrodollar. Japan doesn't pay for all of his things in petrodollars. India doesn't pay for everything in petrodollars. People have been leaving it. The reason there's a petrodollar was post-World War II was a matter of convenience. You had hyperinflation in a lot of European countries and Russia, to where, you know, the ruble could change between, you know, Saturday to Monday significantly, and the dollar was a stable currency that couldn't be manipulated. And they chose to have a reserve currency in the dollar because it was the most stable and it was convenient. That's all it was. And you have people blaming, like, the Iraq war on the petrodollar. That's bullshit. Because, like, they thought Saddam was going on the euro. That's bullshit. Because the war propaganda for Iraq started before the EU or the euro existed. It came from the Office of Special Plans, a bunch of Jewish neocons in the Pentagon that regurgitated lies to start a war. I've heard the nonsense about the gold dinar and Gaddafi. That's bullshit, too. It's because the Egyptian Revolution allowed the Suez Canal open and Gaddafi reneged on billions, tens of billions worth of dollars of oil contracts because he could directly sail to China rather than having to sell to Europe. I mean, there is no, like, simple, like, oh, it's the dollar. Like, having a dollar reserve, it's like, okay, I give you four quarters instead of a piece of paper. It doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, I would say...
You can exchange these for the other currency anyway.
I would say, I mean, I don't know about all of this. You know, we always see these memes go around that are, you know, not sourced after every foreign conflict. Every single time that the U.S. bombs a country, somebody posts a meme about, hey, we're going to start buying oil with something else, right? And I think that those are poorly sourced, you know, conspiracy theories, but the dollar being the world reserve currency and the primary currency in which oil is traded, I do believe it has to play a great deal of a role in foreign conflicts. And it also is allows the United States to export its inflation and visit that misery upon the entire planet. When you have everybody is trying to use your currency, you can afford to print a lot more of it before people get wise in the form of price increases, right?
Yes, exactly. And I think the reason why, I mean, there's no other logical reason why the U.S. would spend this much on its military, and how can we afford to have such an artificially
size
of government and debt?
Because the U.S. has the largest market in the world, and because the government employees personally profit through the weapons industry, through corporate welfare and insider trading. That's why they spend so much on the military.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot
okay,
of. I
but
think
then
that
what about the
I think that, I think that on top of I think that on top of all of this, I mean, there's always a significant interest to have a large military, right? I mean, if you've got the most powerful military in the world, I mean, it's kind of a handy feature, right? I like having more guns than my
more
neighbors.
More expensive doesn't mean stronger; it just means more expensive.
Well, there's certainly that, and I thank you very much for the call, sir.
F-35 is an absolute piece of shit, and they spend over half $1 billion per plane, and it doesn't even have a landing hook for aircraft carriers. The F-22 is a piece of shit. You have the pilots passing out because of the convoluted oxygen uptake system they have running through the fucking sleeve instead of having liquid air like they've always had. But it costs a lot. It's like the Bradley fighting vehicle. There's a movie about it. I mean, they spend billions of dollars and they put every bell and whistle on these things, because they want to involve as many places in the United States for congressional districts, you know, gerrymandered into, you know, profiteering in certain areas for votes. And they make things, and it's not to be effective. It's not to win wars. It's to make money.
Well, there's certainly that. I mean, even just in my own, not being an expert on military hardware, but in my own weapons buying experience, there is no upper limit to what you can spend on weapons, and I'm sure they make every use of that they can. 206, you're on the Radical Agenda. What's your agenda?
Hey, Chris, how you doing, man?
Don't ask me how I'm doing. Get on with it.
Okay, so have you ever watched the Yuri Bezmenov videos? They go around, you know, the various threads. Just to give you an insight, he's allegedly a former KGB subversive agent. And he had, in the late 80s, a series of videos where he describes the actual role of the KGB was to subvert Western society. Are you familiar with this at all?
Well, I'm not surprised that that foreign intelligence agencies try to fuck with, you know, societies. So I'm not familiar with exactly what you're referring to, but I imagine the CIA does a great deal of subversion in other countries. I would, you know, I'd be surprised if other countries did not do subversion here, right? I mean, we were just talking the other day about, you know, the congressman getting swept up in U.S. spying on Israel, talking to foreign heads of state over there, and then we went into the story of his name escapes me, but this Israeli spy who was locked up in the United States for all these years. Now they were talking about. They were talking about, trading, you know, intelligence secrets or whatever, but I'd be shocked to find out that they weren't involved in political movements and staging all manner of activity.
Well, but, the KGB always said they would bring us down from within. Go ahead, caller, sorry.
So the whole point of this, though, is, you know, I was listening to the guys on The Right Stuff, and they were sort of poo-pooing of, you know, why would the left go after the NRA? And their only option was, well, it's because white people join that. And I really don't think that's the case. If you watch the Bezmenov videos, it makes more sense that they're essentially trying to subvert every Western organization they can at once. It's sort of a multifaceted cultural Marxism, multi-pronged attack. So, and eventually everything gets torn down at once and you have useful idiots out there that are going to do your bidding for you, and they do this bidding sort of as an exchange for that dopamine release, the validation they get.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say, if you listen, you know, when you're listening to TRS, you're listening to a lot of different productions like it. They will equate everything to race, you know, and I think that that is misled because there's ideological things, there are monetary incentives, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world aside from race. And, I think it's important that somebody does focus on the racial issues because I think most people completely overlook it. But, you know, if that's your sole focus, then I think that you're going to end up missing as much as if you only focused on, you know, any other single topic, right?
The left really hates anything they associate with masculinity, too, and they certainly think of the NRA as that, and so they're going to attack it for that reason, too. They are pathologically afraid of what, in their minds, feels masculine or strong or superior. And I think the left are the biggest racist ever because they have this paternalistic sense of racism where they gotta, you know, them, the overlord superior, they gotta raise everyone else up and give them special help and stuff. And that's really a slap in the face because it's just hiding their own fucking belief in superiority.
Colin?
I almost argue that the left is more of a matriarchy, than a patriarchy. But,
well, I mean, this is what it is. They wanna like feminize the society, right? I mean, it's heavily influenced by this feminist crap. And I mean, you know, my argument with it is basically that they are just terrible people. I'm literally to a point where I'm not even trying to assign a perceived positive value to it. I literally think that they're just out to destroy everything. And I thank you very much for the call.
They got a massive inferiority complex on the left, and Ted Kaczynski summed it up well with his surrogateness and over socialized leftism. If you want to read that in the manifesto, but. Massive inferiority complex, and they hate anything that they perceive to be strong or better or good or winning. That's where they're going to come shit all over that. They are obsessed with having victimhood status. It is part of their core ideology.
Yeah, they're the fucking rabbit people, and it revolves around single motherhood and all manner of shit. So ANC report, was it, .com?
Yeah, ANC as in anti-neocon. report.com.
Okay, ancreport.com to catch up with Ry Dawson. You'll find his YouTube channel and everything else there. I thank you very much for the call, sir. I'm going to drop your call and I'm going to wrap up the program here. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're watching on YouTube, you go ahead, hit that thumbs up button, why don't you? It does help other people find the program so that more people hear it when I say this show is brought to you by you, the listener. I literally cannot do this without you. I need you, need you, need you to go over to christophercantwell.com/donate and consider making a contribution to the program. if you do $10 a month, I'm going to suggest $10 a month. If you want to do five, you want to do 20, whatever you want to do. If you want to do nothing, you don't owe me shit. It's not behind a paywall. But, you know, I really only have the one advertiser on here, Amazon. If you click the Amazon banner on the website, you go to ChristopherCantwell.com/Amazon, bookmark it, and then, you shop through there, I get a piece of the action. But other than that, you might have noticed we did 2 hours of live radio tonight, and we did not have any commercial breaks. That is because this is a listener-sponsored program, and if I'm gonna keep on doing it, then I need you to fund it. And go over to ChristopherCantwell.com/donate to do that. I accept the PayPal, you could do it one time, you could do it monthly, we do the Patreon, I accept Bitcoin, I trade in a Bitcoin economy. I don't just put it onto the exchanges and drive down the value of your assets. I actually use Bitcoin, so I would encourage you, if you have some of that wonderful, wonderful cryptocurrency, that you consider handing some of it over to me, because I will make excellent use of it. We do this every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and if you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher or on YouTube at some other time, I invite you to join us for the live program. You can catch it on TuneIn, the Radical Radio Network. You go to ChristopherCantwell.com/live, or you subscribe to my YouTube channel, which you should have done by now already, by the way. Everybody who's on YouTube who has not subscribed to the channel, why don't you go ahead and do that? Hit the fucking subscribe button there. It's long overdue. And then, you know, we do it every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We're probably going to get to 5 days a week. But whatever the case is, when you do listen to the live program, as you've seen, we take calls on the air. So if you think that I'm a fucking asshole, why don't you call in and, you know, tell me what's wrong with what it is that I'm doing? A lot of people like to talk shit out there. And, I think that, it'd be a swell thing if they, you know, decided to respond to a challenge, you know, try to challenge me, on the air, you know, instead of talking shit on the fucking internet and making me block you on Facebook because you're a douchebag, you know? So, yeah, I'm actually, right after we're done here, I'm going to go head over. I'm going to do an episode of The Daily Show with the guys from TRS, therightstuff.biz. That'll be out in a couple days, likely. I think they would probably be out tomorrow. I forget what day they released that on, but I will be on the next episode of TRS, therightstuff.biz. So make sure to check them out. Always a lot of fun. ChristopherCantwell.com/donate. I will see you Wednesday, if not before. When we do the special episodes, by the way, you can get notified of them if you go to ChristopherCantwell.com/subscribe. Get on my email list is a swell thing for you to do, because then you get notified whenever I make a blog post and all of that shit. We got, you know, I do a bit of writing too. You might be aware if you're not already just listen to, if you're just listening to the podcast, you might want to check out some of the writing, because I, some people think I'm pretty fucking good at that, huh? So, I will see you Wednesday, if not before. Thank you for tuning into the Radical Agenda. Have yourselves a wonderful evening. Good night.